That's right.
Like
now, now it's like,
oh, no, we're going to use
it. I thought I'd try to catch people.
I owe you a list, but I've got to get some things for him.
Welcome, good afternoon. Hopefully everyone has a packet of information in front of them and has received all the information in the mail. Hearing no comments to the contrary. If you take a look at the agenda, you'll see that we have a number of items that we'd like to cover today. So the first order of business is to take a look at the agenda. So the agenda includes some administrative parts, just an update from Bill Becker and myself about some activities that have gone on since our first meeting on the 1st of December. We have some draft operating procedures of the council that have been worked on by a committee of this council, and we are presenting those to you for an action item. Item number seven, which is a discussion we're going to have with Tom Landwehr from the Nature Conservancy about a listening session that the Nature Conservancy is organizing in early January as part of the DNR's roundtable activities. The bulk of the discussion, or a very critical element of our meeting, is talking about how we plan to proceed, particularly in the near term between now and April 1st, in order to get our first set of recommendations to the legislature by the requirement to have those recommendations to them by April 1. Following that, we're going to talk about timelines for meetings. I know Bill and staff have been very busy trying to coordinate schedules and find times of the week that will work for the most members, so we're going to talk about laying out a schedule between at least here and April. And I think that would be it. I guess I would entertain a motion to approve the agenda.
So moved.
And do we have a second?
Second.
Any discussion?
Other than the public comment?
Yes.
Could you?
Yeah, go ahead.
I believe there was a couple of individuals that wanted to have public comment. If we could arrange a few minutes on that in the schedule someplace.
That would be fine. Typically, we would do this, I would think, at the end of the meeting, but if the people who are here can stay to the end, we'd love to put an opportunity for public comments. I'm seeing some shakes of the head. Yes, great. So let's plan to put that on as a new number 11, which is public comments. Any other suggested changes to the agenda? Hearing none, all those in favor of adopting the agenda as modified signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? We have an agenda. Next item is approval of our meeting minutes from December 1. Hopefully everyone's had a chance to look at those.
Let's see. They're noted as agenda item 3 in the packet you picked up today off of the table.
Okay. So we have a motion to approve the minutes of the December 1st council meeting.
I'll move to approve the minutes.
Motion to approve, and do I have a second?
Second.
Second. Any discussion on the motion to approve the meeting minutes as drafted? Hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? We have meeting minutes approved. Bill, I'll turn the agenda over to you. You have a number of items to share.
Thank you, Mike. This is under the agenda item, administration and budget update. Wanted to let you know that we are making some progress on getting a budget together. We have not completed it yet. We've identified $135,000 that can be used as a loan to the council. Our first request for finance to set this up as a program, which is the equivalent of setting it up as a division so that it tracks in the budget, was denied by finance. The deputy direct commissioner is requesting again to see that it be done that way. If that's impossible, then we will set it up as a set of accounts in the Division of Fish and Wildlife, and it won't track nicely in the biennial budget as a result. The problem is that finance needs an appropriation to set up a program level item in the budget, and they have no appropriation. All we have is the language and statute, and that's what we're basing our request on. So that's where we stand on the budget. This will have to be reflected in the change item that needs to be prepared for the governor's budget process, describing the staffing budget for the council. Specifically, the change item will have to reflect the advance of $135,000. I might also add that we've established a coding block for people in the Department of Natural Resources who provide direct assistance, such as the young lady who's called you about your schedules and things of that sort, to code their time so we can keep track of what the true cost of operating this is for the 6 months that we are up and running. On administrative matters, job descriptions are all drafted based on the LCCMR setup of staffing. We have to question whether or not that's the type of staffing we want. But that was a good model to start with, and so that's what I did start with. We're working to procure the equipment and things of that sort that we need to operate. It's not going to be possible throughout the life of this council to borrow recorders and things of that sort. So we're getting your nameplates made and that kind of business. We also have some people working on meeting room space alternatives and office space alternatives so that when the time comes, we'll have that data ready for you. As far as setting up council meetings and the administrative part of that, I think as you go through the agenda today, we do need some advice on location, where we want to have these meetings and that sort of thing. I've been collecting a list of informational presentations that have been suggested by members and others, and there are maybe a dozen items on there. I've got copies if we need it, enough copies for the onlookers. And then last but not least, I've worked with the DNR planning staff to see about engaging their services if we want to do a strategic plan and want to use them. As we reach the point where we have funds available, we have all other alternatives than using DNR staff, so keep that in mind. But if timing is such that we need to go straight ahead with doing some planning sessions, we have individuals in DNR from Ecological Services, from the Office of Management and Budget Services, and that type, that are professionals in facilitating planning and could give us a little bit of a hand if we wanted to do that. So DNR is ready, willing, and able to do as the council wishes. The commissioner this morning said, make sure you tell them that I'm pledged to see that the council gets what it wants. So tell us what you want, we'll get it for you. Thank you.
That's it, Bill?
Yes.
Great. Any questions of Bill?
Rick? Mike, back on the first question of the appropriations issue and the money. And at the last meeting, there was some discussion about the Senate and the House leadership meeting with the governor's office or with the LCC to give some type of approval or funding. Has anything happened with that?
Not to my knowledge. We've been tracking directly on finding funds immediately that can be used and potentially, well, and repaid, not potentially repaid. I will go back and check with the deputy commissioner as to where we are on that so that we can get it moving.
Yes, Ellen.
Yeah, thanks, Mr. Chair. I just want to ask about, you said $135,000, I think, Bill, as the recommended budget amount. I'm just wondering where that number comes from and how, if you have a budget sort of breakdown proposed.
Roughly, it does cost. I have done a budget breakdown. If you all would like it, I'll send it to you. It says that it costs a little bit over $800,000 to run the council staff. It's a very rough budget for a year. 6 months then would be in the $300,000 to $400,000 range, depending on how fast you fill positions and how many positions you fill. The $135,000 is more based on what's available in DNR budgets than what it takes to run the council. What we can afford out of that is you can afford your executive director's salary. you can afford an administrative assistant salary, you can afford some miscellaneous expenses and travel expenses.
For the rest, for a year?
For 6 months.
For 6 months, gotcha.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Bob.
And as I think I understand, we talked about this last at our last meeting, the Department of Revenue actually won't really see the receipts, the tax receipts, until the middle of August. So you might argue that we may have maybe the first 2 months of the next fiscal year of operation without income. And we also need to acknowledge that whatever funds we get from DNR is effectively a loan that we have to repay. So, Bill, do you have an understanding or at this point with DNR about that, let's say, 2 months of next fiscal year?
Mr. Chair, Bob, I have not discussed the 2 months yet, and I think it's appropriate to do that. That is a bit of a different issue, because at least there'll be funds coming in theoretically in the fiscal year, but not right at the beginning. So I think how we handle that needs to be addressed. Good question.
Any other questions for Bill?
Yes.
Wayne.
Is there any benefit to possibly sharing staff services and space with LCCMR? Or are we in a position where that everything must be kept totally separate?
Bill?
Mr. Chair, Wayne, this is a question I have never considered, and would like to take some time to research it and to see what the situation is with regard to that. I think that's my best answer.
Okay.
I'll be happy to do that.
And Mr. Chair, Shelley is here from LCCMR. I'm not going to say your last name right, so sorry. Shreffler, thank you. And maybe we could just note that she's here, and perhaps she could talk to the other staff there and at least give us some information at a later date about in response to that.
Great, yeah, good suggestion. Yes, Rick?
Just a different administrative issue that in the House here and with the recording, if you have your cell phones and Blackberries, that's the feedback that you're hearing on the recording device. So it encouraged people to turn off their cell phones or Blackberries. And I know people in the audience, but it does disrupt the recording of the.
So. Great, thank you. Other questions or comments for Bill on the work he's been doing? And I should say he's been doing a great job. Bill and I are probably talking daily, several times, I think, most days, and he's very busy trying to get this up and running and very dedicated to this. So thanks, Bill, for the hard work.
Thank you.
I have a few things I'd like to share with you, just from the perspective of the interim chair. I guess the first order of business is when we met as a governance committee here about a week and a half ago, one of the things we agreed to is while we're certainly going to be we want to follow our protocols and our rules of order, whatever they may be, Roberts or whoever. We agreed that we'd like to keep this on a first-name basis only, if possible, if that's agreeable to the rest of the committee members. I mean, we are a creature of the legislature by law, but we are also somewhat different, very different in many respects. So if it's okay with everyone, I'd assume keep it at that level of discussion. So, Scott, that's how I'd like to address.
Good for me.
Oh, great. Okay. Another thing that I think many of you are aware of is that the House, and maybe Rick can shed some light on this, has created a new finance division to deal with cultural and outdoor resources. And my only comment is I plan to have a conversation with the chair of that committee soon, just to try and get a better understanding of the role they see that committee playing vis-a-vis our work as a council. I don't know, Rick, if you have anything to add.
Just the House has named the committees for the coming session, and Representative Mary Murphy chairs that committee. It'd be a finance committee, but the membership of those committees has not been named yet, and I anticipate that probably will not occur until right before the first of the year or shortly after.
I just wanted to make a comment related to that in the Senate. I just want to introduce Senator Tom Saxhog. Do you want to wave? There's Tom. And Senator Saxhog is from the Grand Rapids area and is the vice chair of the finance, the Environment, Energy, and Natural Resources Finance Division, which I chair. He also chairs a subcommittee called Natural Resources, which I think probably would be, we're not planning to set up a separate committee for the process of reviewing this recommendation, but it probably would be originating in Senator Saxhawk's subcommittee, and he's had a great deal of interest in this area. So,
great.
Thanks for being here today.
Yeah, thank you. Welcome, Tom. Any other comments on that point? As Bill mentioned, there's been a lot of work within the department to try and find us some money because, as it stands now, anything that is a cost to this council, you know, per diem reimbursement for travel, is coming out of the department's budget. I've had some conversations with Deputy Commissioner Lori Martinson about that. They're working very hard to find some money for that. It looks like, as Bill indicated, that we are going to have some money very soon to be able to work with in the interim, and it would be a loan. I want to, as Bill mentioned, make that clear. That would be a loan from wherever that money comes from that we would be repaying back once we have money coming into the account or into the fund. And so along that lines, one of the things I would like to do, and I'll probably take this up under the discussion of our council timeline or future meeting schedules, I'd like to appoint a personnel committee, assuming that we have some process for appointing. We have that in our protocols, and assuming that goes through, I would like to get a personnel committee established very soon. And so think about your willingness to serve on this committee. That would be a very important committee because, obviously, if this council is going to function effectively, we need very good staff to make this work. And so we want to move on that as soon as we can. So we'll take that up towards the end of the meeting. But think about now your potential interest in serving on that. The other thing I just want to call your attention to is we have some protocols that we're going to be dealing with as the next item, and if in fact those go through in some shape or form as close to what is drafted, I would like to have an election of interim officers at the next meeting in January. So think as well about your interest and willingness to serve as an interim officer of the council, and as we go through the protocols in just a minute or two, you'll see what that word interim means and what that commitment means. So keep that in mind. With that, I would like, unless there are any questions or any comments, I will tell you that I suspect from all members that are present, there's just a tremendous amount of interest in this council, whether it be Scott talking on KFAN and did a great job talking about the role of the council and the importance of it, but I suspect everyone is getting a lot of input, feedback, suggestions, direction, however you want to call it, about the work of this council, very high expectations. That is why we need to move forward and move forward in a fairly quick way. And one of the first things we need to do is to adopt some operating procedures. Bill, I'll turn it over to you, and if you could just walk the council through the document that's in front of them.
Thank you, Mike. What I'm going to do is take you through this at relatively high level, and then we'll come back and go through each section in detail and ask if anyone has a recommendation for a change for a section. Basically, the operating procedures are divided into four sections.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair.
And yeah, Bob.
Members of the council, this was a product of the Governance Committee meeting of last week.
That's correct.
And so the members of that, you want to just refresh council who the members of that committee were?
Let me see. Les was a member of the committee. Bob was a member. Bill Richardson was a committee member. Rick Hansen, Ms. David Hartwell, and you. And the draft that I'm working off of is the draft you picked up off of the table. It has agenda item 6 in the lower right-hand corner and committee draft 12-12-2008 in the upper left-hand corner. Basically, there are four sections. The first section establishes the council. The second section describes the duties of the officers. The third section describes the committees, three of which there are, and the fourth section discusses the staff. Under establishing the council, the operating procedures talks about the powers of the council, the membership, duties of the council, periodic organization, or the election of officers, council operations, which include duties, reportability, quorum requirements, conflict of interest procedures, rules of order, open meetings and transparency and audits.
The duties of the LOHC officers are described by officer in a letter apparent. I won't go through those in detail. And the committees that are discussed are the executive committee, other committees, and the personnel committees. And I might add that suggesting to get those in the proper order might be useful. Other committees ought to come last in that list. And then there are the items dealing with the staff director. So with that, Mike, I think that the best thing to do is to start with Section 1, which is the powers of the council.
I think I'd like to do is just entertain a motion to adopt these operating procedures, and then once we have a motion on the floor, we can talk about any changes to that. So do I have a motion to adopt these procedures? Rick, okay, in a second?
Second.
Okay, in a second. Okay, so discussion on the operating procedures. Bill?
First, item, by any chance, I've got one here that was mailed out a draft that's 12-15-08, which is 3 days after the 12-12. Is there any difference between the two, or is the 15 more recent?
Bill?
I have to go through the document to
check on this.
Let's see. Mr. Schroeder, where would be one of your changes?
Well, let's see. You know, one of the first things we had was, on that second page, vice chair. Remember we had two by mistake?
Mm-hmm. Right.
This has the let's see. This,
I have a 13 and a 12, and the 13 looks the same as the 12 to me.
You have a 12-13 draft?
Yeah.
Well, let me just say this. What we handed out at the meeting today is the 12-12 draft, and I think if we would work off that, it's the one that has agenda item 6 in the lower right-hand corner.
Okay. Everyone has that?
This one.
And Wayne, you've got that one?
Yep.
Okay.
So we have a motion on the table.
Yeah, so Bill, you were in the middle of saying something regarding these, or are you completed it?
I'm ready to go.
Okay.
Them and do amendments.
Okay. I guess I would ask for any comments or proposed changes to the these operating procedures as proposed.
Mr. Chair, should we go through this just section by section, just briefly?
I think that would be a good idea, just to refresh council members' memory about what's in the material. So, Bill, do you want
to? So, Section A describes the powers of the Lasard Outdoor Heritage Council. And indicates that the powers derive from Minnesota Statutes 97A.056, which is attached as an exhibit. And periodically, the state laws may grant the council powers as appropriate.
Okay.
Membership and organization. The membership is defined in Minnesota Statutes 97A.056. It describes how a vacancy is filled. And describes the statutes guiding compensation and removal, which I believe are 15.0575 is also attached. Section C is duties. The major duty is providing a recommendation on an annual basis. It shows the statute verbatim that directs that us, and also points out that the council shall consider the preservation plan, Minnesota Conservation and Preservation Plan, and other plans as appropriate in making their recommendations. Also, the council and statute is directed to establish a conservation partners program to encourage local conservation efforts. And it points out that the approval of the recommended the recommendations by the council requires an affirmative vote of 9 members or a supermajority. Section 2 is periodic organization, which describes the officers, the executive committee, election, nominations, and the such. The membership structure, which was recommended by the governance committee, includes one chair, one vice chair, one secretary, and one treasurer. The elections for officers, nominations for executive committee position by written sign-up or by a nomination at a meeting. And there's an order to which they are to be filled, which you may want to consider whether this is truly the right order. I've had suggestions that the treasurer might be an officer that you want to elect early to take advantage of the talents in the council.
So, Bill, just so that I'm clear on the order, so that you would go in turn, that each appointing authority is represented through one of these officers for the first three positions. Is that right?
That would be found in item C under election of officers. I'll get to it in a second, Mike, if that's okay.
Sure.
The initial officers' terms are through June of 2009. Thereafter, elections are to be held in June of the even-numbered year within 30 days of the date when the legislature adjourns to a date it specifies in the following odd-numbered year, which is the definition of sine die. And the chair, vice chair, secretary, and chair, treasurer serve until the successor has been elected. The distribution of officers, this is where there is some language that makes sure that each of the three entities, the governor, the House, and the Senate, are represented on the executive committee. The chair will be elected from among all appointing authorities. The vice chair will be elected from among the remaining appointing authorities, appointees, not appointed by the appointing authority of the chair. So that means that if the chair is the appointed by the governor, then the vice chair is either a House or a Senate appointee. The secretary will be elected from among the remaining appointees, not appointed by the appointing authorities of the chair and the vice chair. So if the chair is the governor's appointee and the vice chair is the House appointee, the secretary is one up from amongst the Senate appointees. The treasurer will be elected from among all appointees. The rationale for that, once again, is that the treasurer position may require some special skills, and you want to pick the best person in the council to take care of the financial matters. The other reason for doing that is that if it's a selection from amongst one of the appointees, it would be out of balance. So we'll just take it from among all of them. Nomination and election will be by the entire LOHC membership. A majority vote of the members present for each position is required. Election will be by written ballots. Proxies are allowable in elections only, and there are rules and procedures for how to deliver your proxy. Vacancies in council offices will be filled by election within 45 days of receipt by the council of written notification of vacancy.
Mr. Chair, let me just interrupt. When you said, Chair, you can only use a proxy for election of executive committee members, does that mean, and you cannot use a proxy in the voting on the recommendations of the council? Is that what that's intended to be talking about? It's only for the election of officers. In
this is going to be hard for me
to
do.
Not for any other matters?
It's going to be hard for me to do, Ellen, but instead of Senator.
Call me Ellen. I know you do. Everyone is so well trained around here.
That's what I believe the intent is.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Operation.
Any other questions on?
Yeah. Mr. Chair.
Bob.
I wanted to just introduce a concept. We don't have to decide this right now, but David was the one who raised the notion that we would have an additional responsibility on the executive committee of treasurer, which I fully support and think that makes a lot of sense, someone who manages the money and so forth. And I would keep open the idea that perhaps we have a dual position, secretary/treasurer, which would not be extraordinary, and from other practices and so forth, it might be more easy to manage perhaps in the future. And given, frankly, the limited duties of the vice chair and the secretary, I don't know that it would be a gigantic burden to consider that. And David was the one who introduced it, so it's really, you know, a thought for you as much as anything.
Yeah. Dave?
I think my point was more that there was a need for a treasurer, someone
which
who was watching the money,
right,
both on the operating budget and the allocation, who was on the council, who was looking at that and reporting to the council, so it wasn't a staff-only function.
And I interpret our procedures as drafted that we could have someone filling both of those roles.
Right. Yeah. So I don't think we have to decide it now. We're going to vote at the next council meeting on officers.
That's correct. And
so perhaps as we individually think about that might be something to consider, and if so, we might want to modify these if we were to take that path as a joint function, secretary/treasurer.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Mr. Chair,
what
does a secretary exactly have to do? I mean,
they'll
probably have staff to do the recording and the minutes and all that. So I guess I'm wondering, are there other specific responsibilities we're envisioning for a secretary?
You're making my point.
Yeah, Ellen, I think that as drafted here, and we'll get to it in a bit, I think it's just to fill the the chair or the vice chair's position in their absence. Well, running the meeting.
And Mr. Chair, and the law requires that we have those three officers.
Not secretary.
No.
Chair, vice chair, and secretary.
Oh, I see.
Not treasurer.
Not treasurer, but we do have the authority to
combine them.
Or do something along those lines.
Sure.
So I'd keep that open.
Yeah, Rick.
Mike, was there something in the maybe is that later about designee duties? Because I think we ran in at the governance that there had to be a that a citizen could not approve travel, right. Authorized travel. That has to be a legislator that signs and approves travel. Is that correct?
Yeah. Bill, can you call that discussion?
My understanding, at least in terms of signing off on reimbursement for travel, is that given the way the budget is set up, the Department of Natural Resources executive director has the ability to sign off on that. But that's a different question than one you asked, which is authorizing travel. And I'm not familiar with the legislative rules. So when we get to the point where we talk about travel, we should bring that up and craft some language that reflects the existing policy in the House and the Senate.
So, members, if you look at page 6, kind of jumping ahead, section 2, duties of the chair or his designee, it should really be gender neutral, his or her designee, authorizes travel. At least that's the way we have it drafted now. Any other comments or questions of going back to section C? Dave?
I have one thing. The nomination and election of the chair and vice chair will be by the entire membership. Why wouldn't it be secretary and treasurer as well? I think we missed something.
D?
I think that's David, I think that's an artifact of converting it from the LCCMR procedures, in that you've noted an error that needs to be corrected.
So, Bill, can we just change that to say nomination election of council officers?
Yes.
Okay. Thanks for picking up on that.
Lucky.
We'll see. Any other comments? Okay. Bill?
Duties. The council shall recommend the budget plan for expenditures from the Outdoor Heritage Fund. I believe, incidentally, a budget plan is a term of art that derives from the LCCMR operating procedures. Reportability. In addition, in pursuant to the above, the council reviews and acts upon information provided from, and then there's a list of people who it is anticipated may request or direct the council to do something. Recommendations, findings, and observations of the council are forwarded to the appropriate agencies or entities under the signature of the chair or executive director. This includes approving proposed amendments to project accomplishment plans. This is in anticipation of there being project accomplishment plans or something similar to that to guide the appropriations that you recommend. Quorum requirements. The requirement is 7 members. And the majority of qualified members of any council committee constitutes a quorum. And that's derived from Minnesota Statute 645.09. Defined quorum as a majority of members. Governing conflict of interest. The LOHC is bound by Minnesota Statutes 97A, conflict of interest. Basically, a council member may not be an advocate for and against or against a council action or vote on any action that may be a conflict of interest. You must disclose it as soon as it's discovered. We are required by statute to follow the conflict of interest procedures, policies, and requirements of the Minnesota Department of Administration Office of Grants Management. And those are attached to the procedures. For the purpose of this section, a conflict of interest exists when a person has an organizational conflict of interest or direct financial interest, and those interests present
and those interests present the appearance that it will be difficult for the person to impartially fulfill the person's duties. An organizational conflict of interest exists when a person has an affiliation with an organization that is subject to LOHC activities, which presents the appearance of a conflict of between organizational interests and council member duties. An organizational conflict of interest does not exist if the person's only affiliation is being a member of an organization. In addition to the above, the following applies to the members. Member may not serve as a project manager for a request for funding. A member may not receive direct financial benefit from a request for funding. I might add that these may need to be changed depending on how we decide to go about our business of making recommendations. Conflict of interest to be managed through procedures. There are reasons you've been appointed, and it's because of your background. Then your background is in the area that the council is dealing with. Therefore, it's quite possible that conflicts of interest that need to be managed may arise, including receipt of personal financial benefit from a proposing organization or request for funding being reviewed, serving as an employee or governing board member of a proposing organization whose request for funding is being reviewed, or having a family relationship with someone requesting funds, or a staff or board member of a requesting organization. And I want to make a parenthetical note that we will, in a second, get to the definition of family as it's used here. Procedures regarding conflict of interest. You must identify it before or during the initial request for funding in the review process. And you must complete the Lessard Council Conflict of Interest Disclosure Form and file it in the LOHC office. That is also in your packet. It looks like this. It is noted also, Agenda Item 6. And on page 1 of 2, the footnote defines family. As such persons as habitually reside under one roof and form one domestic circle, or such persons as are dependent on each other for support, or among whom there is a legal or equitable obligation to furnish support. What this eliminates from classic definitions of family is ancestry.
Okay. Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Ellen. Oh,
where's that definition from?
I don't see it either.
Blacks.
Oh. Hmm. Okay.
An old blacks.
All right. That works for me.
Okay.
Rules of order. The LOHC will use Mason's Manual of Legislative Procedure as the rules of order.
Oh, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Ellen.
Just on that point, as legislators, we're so used to using Mason's, and one of the big differences with other bodies is you don't have to second any motions. So
okay.
That's why I keep forgetting to say anything after someone makes a motion, because I'm not used to seconding, and we won't need to do that. So I'm just letting people know.
And that applies to any motion?
Any motion does not require a second.
Okay. Thank you.
I don't know what the other differences are. That's the only one I'm aware of.
And I'm assuming we can somehow track down this manual of legislative procedure.
We can get you copies, I'm sure. We have them in our Senate desks.
Great.
So you can have a little bedtime reading.
Mike, Bill. Ellen, do you have an abridged version?
A nutshell. That's right.
Open meetings and transparency, point 6. The council will conduct open meetings as described in Minnesota Statutes 978.056 and summarized as follows. Meetings of the council and other groups the council may establish are subject to Chapter 13D, the open meeting law, including provisions of public copies of members' materials, a copy of which, incidentally, is attached if you're interested. Meetings shall be recorded. Meeting records shall be made available to the public in text or other accessible formats. The meeting schedules, agendas, and materials shall be made available to the public in advance, online, and via listserv. The council shall establish a listserv and website for the purposes of communicating with the public. The council may make use of video conferencing to facilitate participation by its members and by those asked to present information to the council. Audits.
Ellen. I'm sorry, David.
I just wanted to mention that we did have a discussion about the open meeting law and sort of where we have to operate from, and probably the some of the difficulties of that, specifically with telephone meetings for people who have to travel, and potentially because it is a municipal, not a legislative, open meeting law, even having field trips becomes challenging in terms of the recording, and that we had a discussion about perhaps going back and seeking to legislatively make it easier to have those things addressed than currently we can operate under, but that we have no choice but to operate under the basis that we find ourselves in. I've had a couple of people ask me about this conversation that we had, and that was the extent of sort of the changes that we had talked about at the meeting, and not about throwing out the open meeting law.
Ellen?
On that point, I circled the recording here because I was checking with the LCCMR. We do a lot of site visits and travel as part of our responsibilities, and what the LCCMR does is has, when they do site visits or travel, it's considered an open meeting and it has to be posted and the public is may attend and come to those site visits, but they're certainly not recorded. And I think there's a record kept of all the whatever agenda or materials that are used and shared at those meetings. And I think that would be a really great model for us. That wouldn't require someone to follow us around with a tape recorder, which is rather extreme, and it would still maintain openness and transparency for the public. So it's your understanding that the local open meeting law doesn't allow that?
That was what we were told.
Okay.
Yeah. And in fact, when we get to the next agenda item, mm-hmm. you'll see where this existing provision could have an impact about our participation either individually or collectively in the DNR roundtable-related events. So, yeah. Bill?
I just wanted to say I think we need to do a little research on the definition of the term recorded. My understanding is it's to make a record of, and whatever is reasonable and of the best quality is the way you go about doing it. But I think we need a little research to make sure that that's the case. Audits. Are we ready to go to audits? We audit every 2 years. And it's a financial and program audit, and it's an audit of whether or not the expenditures of appropriations from the fund and the uses to which they are put ensure consistency with the constitutional mission of the fund. Section 2, duties of council officers. Chair. The chair presides over the council and executive committee meetings. The chair serves as primary spokesperson for the council. The chair provides direction to staff. The chair or his designee authorizes travel for council members by written authorization form or memo, by memo or form confirming verbal authorization to be filed with the council office prior to trips. Expense vouchers to be submitted after authorized travel pursuant to guidelines established by the council on the following basis. For public members, as per the expense policy of the commissioner's plan, public members are authorized $55 a day per day on authorized council activities.
I have a thought on that. And we don't know what this rate is going to do over time. It may make sense to just refer to it as the approved whatever this rate comes from versus specifically state an amount and then
I
have to go back
that.
And change
suggestion.
Our operating procedures.
I will do the best that I can there. This is in here because 15.075 subdivision 3 requires authorization by the council for members to get per diem.
Yeah, I don't object to that. I just object to putting in a specific amount because it'll change in 10 years.
The dollar amount.
The dollar amount.
Yeah.
Do what we can.
Wherever it comes from.
Sets the time. The chair sets the time, place, and date of executive committee meetings, council meetings, and authorizes council and committee meetings as well. That may be duplicative. The vice chair performs the duties of the chair in absence of the chair and is a member of the executive committee. The secretary performs the duties of the vice chair in absence of the vice chair and is a member of the executive committee. The treasurer performs the duties of the secretary in the absence of, that's a mistake. In absence of the secretary, is a member of the executive committee and prepares reports on the balance and projected revenue in the Heritage Fund in conjunction with staff, tracks the operating budget and reports to the council on expenses throughout the year, and works to develop annual operating budgets. Minutes. Any council member except the chair may move approval of the minutes. The chair of the meeting in which the minutes were approved will sign the minutes. Section 3, Executive Committee. The Executive Committee reviews and acts upon the following matters. Matters brought forth by the chair and the Executive Committee members, discussion material provided by the Executive Director. Recommends action to the full council. Reviews and recommends council administrative budget to the council. Approves accomplishment plans and periodic payment authorization for conduct of council recommended projects and programs.
Dave?
I have a comment there. Perhaps we should add that is then reported to the entire council.
And this will be under which number, Dave?
Four. I don't think we want to look at every plan, but I think we ought to have some sort of a report that says this is what the executive committee did.
Okay.
Gives policy and program direction to council operations. Deals with audit oversight and compliance, and recommends statutory changes to the council. Other committees of the LaSard Council. Other committees may be appointed by the chair. Personnel committee. Annually reviews performance of the executive director and recommends candidates for the position. We're almost to the end, folks. We're at section 4. The executive staff. A, the executive director. The executive director serves at the pleasure of the council. The council selects and recommends the individual who will serve as the council's executive director to the commissioner of the Department of Natural Resources for appointment. Duties of the executive director are to hire, fire, organize, supervise, and otherwise administer the regular staff within the budget and staffing limits authorized by the council, hire temporary staff and interns outside the limits above, subject to budget availability, administer all council affairs, interact with the legislature and legislative staff, bring to attention of the chair or council members matters relevant to council programs, administer the council budget, reviews for approval all non-member expenses, make corrections consistent with an approved accomplishment plan, review current council programs, develop new programs at the direction of the chair, maintain communications with the legislature, private sector, non-governmental federal, state, and local government agency, make preparations required for all council meetings, provide staff needed by council and council subcommittees, serve as exclusive liaison between consultants and the chair, the council, and committees of the council, approve accomplishment plan changes which will help achieve the intended effect of any appropriation, significant accomplishment plan amendments judged by a relative size of the proposed amendment or by the significance of the impact on the intended effect of the program must be reported to the council for information. Manage auditors responsible for auditing the uses of the fund. Assign responsibility and delegates authority to other staff as appropriate in direct preparation of annual reports on council activities and accomplishments. And that, members, completes the operating procedures of the LaSard Outdoor Heritage Council.
Les, did you have a question?
Yes, Mr. Chair. This question was posed to me this morning about 6:30. The very first line under powers, the council is in the legislative branch of government. Now, the intent of the council was to maintain an autonomous position
And this was part of the ballot question, the constitutional amendment, and the statutory law 297A. And the interpretation is that, yes, we do interface with the legislative, judicial, and executive branch, but is it really part of the legislative branch? And should that paragraph just be, or that sentence be struck with the following part of that paragraph being correct?
Bill?
The sentence derives from the language on page 11 of the handout. Specifically, 978.056 subdivision 2, which reads, the Lasard Outdoor Heritage Council, A, the Outdoor Heritage Council of 12 members is created in the legislative branch.
So this is something less that until the legislation is changed, we are a creature of the legislative branch of government.
And I might add, to be in government, you've got to be in either the legislative, executive, or judicial branch.
Bill,
I have a question. Budgetary-wise, we are, am I to understand that we are going to exist on 1% of the proceeds that come in? What happens, or how do we address dollars that are not spent during a fiscal year? Is that a carryover, or how does that work?
Chair Mike, if they're appropriated, they are available for expenditure until the appropriation is over. If the appropriation is over and their dollars remain in the account, they will go back into the fund. They become available for future appropriations.
But they might be available over a 2 or 3 year period, even though they were appropriated in one particular year.
Okay, so part of the 1%, then, Mr. Chair, to understand that if the 1% is not spent, the remaining dollars go into the general appropriation, then to be put into the programs and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. It's not carried over from one budget cycle to another.
No, the way at least it worked with the LCCMR is whatever came through the legislative process was appropriated to a project for a period of time. They had up to a certain period of time to spend those dollars, and if they couldn't get it done, then it ends up going back into the corpus.
I think, Mr. Chair, Senator, I think you're talking about the administrative funds. If, for example, we were to raise $100 million in a year, we'd get $1 million for administrative purposes. If we don't, and if we received an appropriation to spend $1 million, but only spend $800,
there you go.
Your question is, what happens to the $200?
That's right. Yeah.
Okay. I think the $200, because it's the appropriation is limited in time and scope, my instincts tell me that it would go back to the fund. Mm-hmm. And then another appropriation would have to be requested for the next budget period.
The language that guides us is on page 12 of the handout, item H. Up to 1% of the money appropriated from the fund may be used to cover the staffing and related administrative expenses of the department and to cover the compensation and travel expenses of council members. The interesting thing about this is it's not temporally laid out. The time is not laid out, so it's up, as I understand it, it's up to the wisdom of the legislature and the governor to determine what the length of the appropriation is. You could theoretically have.
That's not guided.
But to your point, if we spent $40 million, we could only have an administrative budget of $400,000. Even if we had $80 million that was possible to spend, I think that's what you're...
Yeah. I think we need to get further clarification on what we're allowed to do with on that
leftover funds at the end of the year, do they go back in? That's all. And where do they go? That's all. I don't know if that's addressed in statute here or not.
And I think, Dave, your point is also a good one. Is that 1% of what is appropriated?
It does say that.
This is what I...
Yeah, and that's how I interpret it. Yeah. You know, I have a real fundamental question about these protocols. I mean, what force do they have beyond just the agreement of this council? I mean, they're not codified. I mean, I see a lot of the similar things that are here that are codified in statute for the LCCMR. These are items that are either in law, which we have no... ability to change unless we change the law or the legislature changes. Or they just happen to, there's something we agree to, but I guess the question comes, for example, things that we're authorized to do or that we're authorizing individuals to do, you know, to what extent do we actually have that power to do that? For example, chair authorizing travel. We're saying in this procedure that chair can authorize travel. Well, in fact, does the chair have that legal authority to authorize travel? I don't know. And so I guess I would defer to folks who deal with this more regularly. What force of law or what power does this have?
Mr. Chair, I don't have the answer to that, except to say the legislature was broad in its language, and I would assume that as long as we are following the legislative intent, we're okay. But that's a very general, broad statement, so I don't know. But if we decide we want to put more detail into law, we can always do that if we want to try to codify some of our rules or principles, because we won't always all be here at the table and there will be other people, and so it does put another level of protection in, and which is why the LCCMR eventually put more statutory language in. Maybe they did that right at the beginning, but anyway, there's, you know, we always have that option to put more into the law if we think that's a good idea.
But this is really our agreement to agree in terms of how we're going to conduct ourselves, and we can change it. You know, if we want to have an executive committee of six in a year because it would work better, we just agree to do that, and we change our operating procedures, and life is good. So this is our rules of engagement with ourselves.
Mm-hmm. Any other comments on these operating procedures as proposed? Yeah, Darby.
I'd like to just ask a question relates to page four, conflict of interest to be managed through procedures. And I note that in the draft of the 12th, there are three bullet points underneath that, whereas in the staff form there were four bullet points. One bullet point was deleted, and I guess I'm just simply curious as to what the discussion was surrounding, and I can read the bullet point that was deleted if you'd like me to do that.
That would be helpful.
Was the third one down in the staff form, and it says, serving with or without pay as a consultant to someone who requesting funds whose request is being reviewed by the council. These are items identified above as where conflict of interest may be.
Mr.
In
Chair.
Effect.
Yeah.
Darby, I had raised that issue because it was unclear to me as to what the definition of consulting was. On an unpaid basis, every one of us has been already asked questions. Is that by maybe folks in the audience and others who may be petitioning the council for funding? Is that a conflict of interest? We're not paid by those folks. We are consulting. They're asking us for advice. I don't think it is, but I thought it would be awkward to have that in there. If you take it to its extreme, you might make the argument that we can't answer questions. And I don't think we want to do that.
No, that's certainly not the case.
Well, so I think that was part of the discussion.
David? We also felt that by identifying that a member can't receive direct personal financial benefit, we were covering that anyhow.
Right.
So it was redundant, in essence.
Oh. Okay.
So
Ellen?
If someone is providing paid consulting services to an organization, and so they're getting paid by the organization, and then the organization is requesting a grant for something slightly different, does that fall under the direct personal gain?
That's an interesting question. The thought was that, you know, it would be all-encompassing. If you were financially connected to the organization, you were conflicted. Mm-hmm. But we may not have gotten it right.
And I think that's, Mr. Chair, I think that makes sense for a definition, that it would be all-encompassing.
Yeah, I think a general rule, if you have to ask the question, do I have a conflict, the answer is yes, because you've asked the question. Well, better to err on the side of the...
Mm-hmm. You know, we have in the in 97A, I mean, subdivision 4 lays out conflict of interest. It has a definition. You know, I'm not sure we have that authority to change what that definition of conflict is. Mm-hmm. And maybe what we have here is very consistent with that. But if you look, this what I'm referring to is exhibit number 2, which is just 97A, the statutes. And if you look page 12, conflict of interest, subdivision 4, and if you look the third line down, the fifth line down, for purposes of this section, a, quote, conflict of interest exists when? And so it seems to me that that has already been defined in statute. In it.
Yeah, the question would be if we have taken it further and more restrictive, which would be our right, it would not be our right to make it looser.
Right, that's correct. So one way we could deal with that is simply in terms of conflict of interest is to reference that part of statute.
Mike's on Bill? Top of page 4 is the reference.
So maybe, I guess the question is, do we need any of those bullets at all, given that we've already specified what conflict of interest is? I mean, if you look on page 5, procedures regarding conflict of interest, that really specifies what happens if you have a conflict of interest. We have this disclosure form and so forth. I'm really wondering whether that paragraph, conflict of interest to be managed through procedures, is even needed. But let me hear from other folks. Yeah, Rick?
Well, it seems like the bullet points do clarify. Provide a little more detail in the statute with some of the and the enabling clause about, you know, members have been appointed because of their interest, so there's going to be folks that are experts in these areas or may serve on boards or commissions other than this that are similar. So I think it may be good to have it in there just to help clarify.
I'm not sure that it doesn't make sense on the second bullet point to say a member may not receive direct or indirect personal financial benefit. That handles Ellen's point of, gee whiz, I'm doing a consulting job for someone, but this branch isn't specifically for that, when clearly we shouldn't be participating if we have that kind of a relationship and a decision, because it will be seen by somebody as a conflict and will be criticized for it.
Does that come right out of the statute, Bill, that item B?
No.
Okay. Folks agreeable to that, this proposed change? That would be under item B, including or indirect financial interest?
Okay. I want to go back, Dave, to what was apparently lifted from the LCCMR, which just doesn't sit very well with me under 2D1A, and somehow budget plan for expenditures we should be recommending an allocation for expenditure. I mean, we're recommending it, but it should be more than a budget plan. I mean, it's a specific targeted appropriation. We're recommending an appropriation. So why don't we just say that? Thank you for giving me the word.
Yes.
I thought about that too.
Budget plan just seems like squishy.
Yeah. I don't know what it is either. Where is it again?
Page three.
See that? We're on page 3.
Three.
Right in the middle of the page under duties, number 1, the first item A.
Yeah.
So you're saying, Dave, the LOHC shall recommend an appropriation for expenditures from that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
The other thing I want to just bring up and hopefully have a discussion about is what we call the person who will run the staff for this organization. And I think it's appropriate. This is considered executive director in this, which was lifted off the LCCMR. But it's a very important thing for us to to think about what the person who is the head of the staff is called and what the relationship of the council is to that person and what that person is seen in the community and their role and the council's role. And executive director may be the right title. It may be council director, it may be council coordinator or something else that provides more of a sense that this is a council providing direction instead of the executive director providing direction. And I'm not sure what, but it's a big deal to start this with what the title will be of the person who is the staff leader. And I'd love to have other people's opinions before we just default into what is in place with the LCCMR.
Yeah, that's true.
Other thoughts on that? Scott?
I agree with that. You know, the term executive director to me comes across as CEO, okay? And I don't know that we want that person to be perceived as the CEO. Council coordinator, I think, is a more accurate term for that position, and I would agree with your comments that would be a better description.
Okay, that's a good point. Okay, other comments,
thoughts? Yeah, I'll buy into that. I think perception and reality are two important things to consider on this. I think that's great.
Okay, yeah. Bill?
I wanted the council to know that the LCCMR term is director, and sympathetic with the discussion here. I made it the executive director because it was in the executive branch, but I think that the further discussion is certainly on point.
What's the difference, council director?
No, whatever you all want.
So Scott had a suggestion of council coordinator. That sits well with folks. Darby?
It's fine.
Okay.
I kind of like Bill's council director.
Okay. Other thoughts on that? We have two ideas. Scott, does council director seem to...
Well, it still implies that person is in charge. You know, I think the chair... I mean, if there's a position that would indicate who is the primary leader, that would be the committee chair, you know.
Bill?
Members, if it is true that this person is the head of the staff, maybe something along those lines is an appropriate term.
Only for consistency. If you look through it, the way most organizations run, even the federal government, if we have a state executive director, a county executive director, it just seems like those things kind of fall in line with that's the titles. It means that they oversee that particular department. So I don't have a problem either way, but director fits.
We can vote on it, or we can look at each other and say that this seems that director seems to work. Scott, what's your? You still would rather have coordinator?
I would prefer it, but yeah. I mean, it really is the group.
I think,
Bill,
for what it's worth, I think coordinator is a good idea too. I think director goes right to the top. I mean, that's perception is that's the person that's in charge of the whole ordeal here. Coordinator would be what exactly that position actually does. Coordinates.
Bob.
Mr. Chair, one thing I'm mindful of is title matters in recruitment.
I was thinking that the very same thought.
That's true.
There's a, we want the very best for the cheapest price we can get. I think it's one way to say it. And if we can
you
achieve
can
the
blunt, Bob.
If we can achieve the latter by allowing the former to be a different type of compensation. That's something I'm aware of. So,
other thoughts? Yeah, Jim.
Well, I think, you know, whether we like it or not, the executive director is going to be the, for the most part, the face and the leader of this organization. I mean, yeah. We are more or less temporary, and I think it. Executive director, I think it does really describe this person's position. So,
Other thoughts? Rick?
So in the absence of any motion, what we have in the body is executive director, right?
We have right now executive director absent any motion. So, and
Mr. Chair, I'll make a motion.
Okay.
I'm sorry. Go ahead, Scott.
You know, if what Jim says is true, is that the executive director is going to be the face of the committee, okay, I would hope that members of the committee, from a public perception, would be the face of that committee, not the executive director, okay, so that those calls would, that those people would respond to us as members, not directing all of that public input to who they think is the director. So, I mean, if that be the case, if the executive director is then determined to be the face of the committee, I think it's probably even more important to try to redirect that focus onto either the chair or the committee in general, not to, you know, business as usual per se. You know, we're really trying to, like, reinvent a new round wheel, you know, and if we can do that by getting lots and lots of interaction with the committee members as the face of that committee, I think that's important.
Thanks. Bob, did you have a...
Well, it seems to me at the moment we have three options. We can stay where we are with the executive director. We can take the executive off and just make it director, or we can take it and make it as a coordinator. So I'll make a motion that it's director.
Okay. We have a motion to title this director. We are not operating yet under these rules, so do we have a second to that motion?
Second.
All right. We have a second. So any discussion on that motion to title this the director?
Okay.
Yes,
Alex? I really don't care very much, so I probably shouldn't say anything. But I the only thing I would add is that executive director is kind of a better used term, better known term than director. And so when someone puts it on their resume, I know what that means. When I'm on a board, I serve on a board of directors, I know who the I know what the executive director is. They're the head staff person that I direct. And I'm not quite sure what a director is. So is there a different definition? Where's our Black's dictionary when we need it? I really don't care that much. I'm just making a comment.
Okay. So we have a motion on the floor to retitle A from executive director to director. Any further discussion on that motion?
I just have a question. How is this executive director working with your... you're the chair who's going to be like, you're the temporary chair. Are we talking the same thing here, or are we talking two different?
These are two different positions. Bill?
As currently described in the job description, which is subject to change at the desire of the council, the executive director reports to the chair for all direction on policy, strategy, things of that sort with regard to the council. So the executive director works for the chair and through the chair for the council.
Thank you. Okay, so we have a motion to retitle this the director. Further discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
No.
Okay, the motion does not prevail. So we are still at executive director. Do I have any motion to retitle that, or can we move on?
I make a motion to rename that as council coordinator.
Okay, we have a motion to retitle that as council coordinator. And a second?
I'll second that.
Okay, we have discussion on that motion to retitle the executive director to the council coordinator. Hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
No opposed.
That motion does not prevail. So we still have an executive director. Any further discussion on this item?
Move to close the discussion and leave it as executive director.
Okay. I don't think we need a motion to do that, but we will move on. Ellen.
Thank you. I want to bring up another point that our staff, Greg Knopf, points out on that conflict of interest, going back to page 4. And I think Greg is right when he points out that if you look at the middle, with the middle two bullets, these are, and I've been trying to read through this and figure out which of these are, how these different paragraphs relate to each other. But this part that says, in addition to the above, the following applies to members of the LOHC. They may not do this and they may not do that. And so these are actually prohibitions.
rather than saying, if you have a conflict under these definitions, you cannot vote, you can't advocate, you have to disclose it. Instead, these go further than that, I think, and these say you can't do it. So if you have any kind of direct or indirect personal financial benefit from anyone who's applying for a project, you can't be on the council anymore. Mm. That's the way I would read it.
I think she's right. Yeah, that's a good point.
And so I hadn't really thought about that. And is that what we want to say? Or should we just say that the other conflict of interest procedures apply under these circumstances, that you, which are enumerated, I think, above in A and...
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I think...
Yeah, Bob.
I agree with Senator Anderson. I think that perhaps eliminating them might make the most sense. In the alternative, it might be to simply say, if a member has a direct personal... a member may not vote if they have a direct... if they receive direct personal financial benefit, for example. That would be an alternative. Am I reading that right?
Mr. Chair, also, yep. Well, first of all, there's two different bullets, and I think they're a little bit different. The first bullet says you can't serve as a project manager for a request for funding, and I think that should be a prohibition, period.
Yeah.
We don't want anyone who serves on the council to come in proposing a project.
Yeah,
that,
I think that's
So then maybe we should just leave that as is, but the second bullet, perhaps we should just move that, or just, I like the language. So I think we should maybe just add that to our definition of conflict of interest in the first A, where it says, this is just a thought, an LOHC member may not be an advocate for an action or vote on any action that may be a conflict of interest, including whatever, may not,
receiving
someone who would receive direct or indirect personal financial, or this includes... a conflict of interest under this sentence includes someone who receives a direct or indirect personal financial benefit from a request for funding. Something like that. Does that make sense?
Does others? Yeah, Bill?
Just a clarification, Ellen. What you really want to do is take that second bullet.
Yes.
And make it a guideline as to what a conflict of interest is, but not a prohibition from serving on the council.
Yes.
Right. So, are folks agreeable to that, Jane? I'm seeing nods of the head, yeah. Okay, that's a friendly amendment.
Yeah,
great.
That's good.
Any further discussion on these operating procedures as proposed? We have a motion and a second on the table to approve these operating procedures. Any further discussion on the motion to adopt these procedures as amended?
I just want to make sure that the motion includes all the corrections that we've all nodded our heads.
And do you want us to go through and enumerate all of those corrections? Yes. And then okay. So that includes the changes as discussed by the council.
And agreed on.
Chair, did that include the one where we were thinking about putting the Secretary Treasurer together?
Yes.
Did we decide to do that?
I'm not sure, Mr. Chair, that we had decided to do that. I was proposing it as a consideration.
I would recommend we do that or consider that.
So just so that we're clear, Wayne, you were referring to page?
It was under the membership structure that it would be secretary / treasurer, instead of separate positions.
Page 2.
Page 2 under membership
Bill?
Structure.
And there was another reference on page 6.
Yep.
7.
To interpret this request for drafting, I think what we want to do is delete all references to treasurer and change all references to secretary to secretary treasurer, and move the duties of treasurer up under secretary treasurer.
Yeah, that makes sense. Thank you. Yeah, thanks for catching that. Yeah, perfect.
I would oppose this just because I think you may have some limits here in terms of what this limits your ability to do a few things in terms of responsibilities and authorities. Because if you define that you have only three, and three must come from one of each, and you have to have a legislator sign on some of these things, and you don't have that option if there's no legislators elected, I think if you have the legislative authority having to approve certain things, you have a cleaner authority line when as a member of the legislative body, people will look at this. So I think it limits you, it limits your choices down the line, and I'd like us to think about that. We may want to do that before, we may want to do it anyway in January of going to three, but I would ask us not to take that right now and to think about just limiting our operational options.
Darby?
My concern really is the number of people on an executive committee. How many people do you would be best? Really, just three? Or would it be better to have a fourth person given the size of this group? That's something I think we ought to think about at any rate. Mm-hmm. The executive committee clearly does have some powers, and I would argue that maybe it's reasonable to have a fourth, not because the fourth slot is so critically important to ongoing activity, but that it really widens the number of folks on the executive committee.
Any other discussion or thoughts? Wayne, would you be agreeable to leaving that as four, or you want a motion?
No, I don't have any problem with it. I wanted to just clarify.
Okay, so we have, those are four distinct positions. Rick, I think that's a good point about kind of the process and the order in which these are nominated. You could really be limiting the scope of your.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, to Darby's point, I think, you know, one of the other things to consider is also in a quorum. If we only have three members, then two can make the decision.
Yeah.
And I don't know if that's necessarily a good thing.
A good thing, yeah.
So.
Very good.
And they want to take us back.
Bill?
Let me just bring up one thing. Has there ever been any discussion about staggering these positions at all? Years? Two versus four? So you don't have a,
that's
some overlap? Number. I guess I just happened to think of that.
Bill?
I don't think it's a big deal.
My understanding of the history of this is that it was originally set up when the Legislative Commission on Minnesota Resources was proposing biennial packages, and this was a cycle that kept the leadership together through the development, the investigation, development, recommendation, testimony about passage of and signature of the LCMR's biennial package. So for the council's information, I think that's the history.
Any further discussion, Bob?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, just to whatever it is we decide to do, if we could post it on the web.
Yes. I think that any of our items for action will be certainly put on the LOHC website. Yeah. Hearing no further discussion on the motion to adopt these operating procedures as amended through the discussion today, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? We have operating procedures. Thank you. Thank you to the Governance Committee for your great work in putting that together. The next agenda item is a discussion that we would like to have with Tom Landwehr from the Nature Conservancy. And Tom and Bill and I have had a series of discussions regarding an opportunity to get some information to the LaSalle Outdoor Heritage Council in the near future. So, Tom, welcome.
Mr. Chairman, Mike, thank you, and members of the commission, thank you very much for the chance to come for you today. Before I get into my specific request, I just want to congratulate you all for your appointment to this, and more than anything, thank you for the time you've been spending on this. As I'm sure everybody's already realized in the conversation we've already had today, it's going to be a lot of work and sometimes painful work. You're not going to be outside over a yellow layout. Doing this work. We very much appreciate the effort that you're spending there to get this money spent right. Most of you are probably aware of the DNR Roundtable. It's something that I think the department's been doing for 10 or 15 years now, and it is held every January. Initially, it was developed as a way for the department to get input about especially hunting and fishing regulations, but has always included representation from the divisions of Fish and Wildlife as well as the Division of Ecological Resources. So it truly is a broad-based constituency of the same interests that the LaSalle Outdoor Heritage Council represents. It is fish, wildlife, native plants, invasive species. It is the whole gamut. And it's going to be quite a huge event every January. It generally starts on a Friday, generally ends on a Saturday. I think the mailing list is upwards of 200 now, and I think it typically gets 150 to 200 people. I mention it, and I'm sure many of you have done it. I mention it simply because it is a very unique gathering that we really only see once a year in Minnesota, where we have this many people representing this broad of a constituency in one place at one time. You have a lot of work to do in the next few months, and you're not. I know you want to get public input. You're not going to have a lot of opportunity to do that. You're certainly not going to have an opportunity to go out of state and talk to people and get a lot of input about how you make these really first-year critical decisions. It occurred to many of us that here's an opportunity when you've got this group of stakeholders that is really a broad-based group of stakeholders, that perhaps there's an opportunity to also bring in the council or council members to really establish a structured dialogue, a dialogue between the council members and this big group of constituency, to have a chance to give at least a snapshot of what this constituency believes might be the priorities, some suggestions on processes, and some suggestions on future input from this constituency to the council. So in combination with Mark Johnson and the Deer Hunters, Joe Dugan and Pheasants Forever, Ryan Heininger from Ducks Unlimited, Dave Zettner and Lance Ness from Duck Rally, we have put together a possible meeting on the Thursday before the roundtable, Thursday, January 8th, at the same place the roundtable is, which is Earl Brown Heritage Center. And I recognize this is a tough time because many of you have real jobs during the day and taking out a work day is a problem, and I appreciate that and would acknowledge that many of you may not be able to be there, but also acknowledge that this is historical precedence, that we have this group, we have this funding source, we have first year of getting this all right. I think it calls for extraordinary measures. So it's going to be challenging to get volunteers from the round table to be there. It's going to be challenging to get volunteers from the council to get there. But really, I'm going to extend an invitation to you, offer requests for as many folks that can be there as possible. What we will do is on that Thursday from 1 to 5, set up a structured discussion. What I really don't see any value in is just having an open mic where everybody just gets up and rants and raves. What we'd very much like to do is set up a structured discussion so that we can get this group of stakeholders and activists to talk about what their priorities are specifically for forests, for prairies, for wetlands, for lakes and rivers, and in a very focused way give you their first gut reaction to what they think the priorities are for this first year. So we're working very closely with Bill and Mike to try and get the questions that you would like to have answered framed up and put in front of this group and get the right people to be in this group. We want several habitat leaders, for instance. So for the forest group, we will ask Mark Johnson and Tom Lyons, Deer Hunters and Turkey Federation, to coordinate that group and start out coordinating that group by talking about what we know already. What do we have for plans for forests in Minnesota? What do we know about programs for Minnesota? What do we have for priorities for Minnesota? So that's an opportunity to educate the stakeholders as well as the council on what we already know, what's already out there for programs and policies, and then go back and talk in small groups about what priorities might be so that we can give you, you know, a Cliff Notes version, if you will, of short-term and long-term priorities for the state of Minnesota. So I just wanted to extend that offer today. We have secured the space. We have set up the agenda. We have secured the team leaders. We're going to be putting meat on the bones here in the next couple of weeks. Expect to get invitations out. Again, I understand it's going to be a terrible burden for some people and won't be able to make it. I appreciate your consideration and acknowledge your inability to participate. But really want to make sure that you understand that we have this outstanding opportunity the first year, and hopefully some or many of you can make it.
Great. Just a couple comments, and I'll open it up for any questions. One of the challenges we have, and Tom and Bill and I have talked about this, under the open meeting law, because we would be receiving members, even individually as council members, if seven or more of us show up at that meeting, it's an open meeting of the council. It's an official meeting, and that's why Bill has and his staff have been calling members to find out, are you available on the afternoon of the 8th? So far we have five individuals, council members, who are able to attend, and I would encourage those people who can to do so. But just to let you know, unless we have an official meeting noticed, if seven people show up, we have to have people leave such that we don't have a quorum. Otherwise, we would be in violation of the open meeting law, at least the way Bill and I have interpreted it. Bob.
Mr. Chair, on that point, this is a meeting that is being hosted by Nature Conservancy and other groups, and Mr. Landwehr is here, I believe, to make us aware of it, mm-hmm. and to attend. If Jerry Bell from the Twins wanted to show up and say that there is a Meet the Twins night, and we were all invited to attend, and seven of us were there at a meeting of the Twins, if we all showed up, I don't know that that's a open meeting law violation. I mean, if we had this discussion, remember, last meeting, if we all went to the same Twins game or Vikings game or something like that.
I think the difference is receiving information, and I guess it's not in statute, but I would interpret that as germane to the work of this council. It doesn't say that, but it says either to make decisions or to receive information. And I guess regardless, one of the things that I would welcome, and not only from this organization, but if we're going to be talking about this as the next item, is receiving public input. Regardless how this comes out, I have asked Tom to have the folks that are involved put together a very concise written summary and be prepared to present this to the council, probably at their next meeting after the roundtable, so that we do have this information in front of us as we go about, you know, our process of trying to develop strategies. And again, not exclusive to this group, but this will be one of many pieces of input. Dave?
I appreciate the offer, Tom, but I'm concerned that this is becoming a council-driven deal where staff is spending time trying to get people and figure out how many people are there, and it's not our agenda. And if we're going to have a meeting, if we're going to have a listening session with the public or something else, we ought to control the agenda versus us being invited to this meeting, because I'll tell you, you know, as great as the meeting will be, there will be 15 other invitations from other people who have a similar agenda, and we're going to spend a lot of time trying to figure out where we go, and staff is never going to be done fielding coordination to events. We have to, with all due respect, I think we really need to spend time figuring out how we want to proceed as a group and how we want to go out and get information before we start expending time of our staff trying to coordinate to attend other events that people are having. And it meant with great due respect, I'm a great fan, but I feel like it's the cart before the horse here.
Yeah, Chair. Les.
Tom? We've been in discussion with this. I think the Thursday is a poor time in the sense that the registration for the roundtable, and I've been a attendance of that for the last 10 years, and it's a great group to get together and discuss all the issues within the state. Friday is going to be a travel date, registration 10 o'clock in the morning, and when you're going to have a limited attendance of the roundtable people there, and my suggestion was after the meeting convenes on adjourns on Saturday around noon, you're going to have a captive audience still there. I think it's a very important group to communicate with. You have all the stakeholders from the state of Minnesota. Last year, I think we had about 450, 500 attendance there, and I think you're going to have a more effective, and I think we have to have a listening session, and I think it's an important interface. Granted, it's stretching everybody's time thin, but just my suggestion that we look at that Saturday afternoon.
Thank you for that. We talked about that at length. We looked at both before and after. I think the rationale for Thursday that won me over was that so many people are crawling to get out of there, itching to get out of there on Saturday. There's just a limited amount of energy, and you know, a lot of people have already taken off. They don't want to spend the whole weekend there. And you know, if that was the only way it would work, I would say, well, let's bite the bullet and do it.
One other suggestion, excuse me.
Yeah,
I did talk to Dave Shad, and I was under the impression that Dave was going to carve out an hour time at the after the opening of the roundtable for the LC for the council. So it's again, if you're coordinating it, but there's a possibility that we become integral to the roundtable. Mm-hmm. So just another suggestion. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Rick.
I plan on going to the roundtable as an individual citizen and as a legislator and to be there, and I think that's a role we can play. But the difference is with the structure. You know, we just spent an hour talking about conflict of interest, and ultimately, you know, and I'm a member of a number of the organizations you mentioned, but being a member is not the conflict. Each of those organizations is going to have projects coming before us, and so by setting up a meeting for the council, would the meeting exist if the council wasn't there? No, it would not. It's a meeting for the council, and it's a meeting to give access. And so I don't think we can do it. I mean, I think that there's a problem there with a conflict because you have, it's not the open meeting law, it's groups expending money to reach us, and I plan on being there as an individual to be reached, but having the actual structure, I think, is a problem.
Bob?
Mr. Lambert, are you going to have the meeting regardless of how many attend?
It was my hope that we could get as many council members as possible, but if we had one council member, I would say it would be beneficial. I mean, truly, this group of people is rare. We'll never get this group of people together again in outside of this annual meeting. So since those people are going to be there, we have the critical mass we need to have the type of meeting we hope to have.
And it's the, Mr. Chair, as I understand it, you are, these groups are going to meet, and you're to gather and collect your thoughts in order to make a formal presentation to the council. And so regardless of our attendance or not, am I correct that it is yours and the other group's intention to meet anyway in order to create that product? So this meeting would exist regardless of our attendance or not.
That's a question I hadn't quite gotten to. If there was zero council members, would we have a full meeting? And I would say, honestly, no. I mean, the principal idea was to have an opportunity where the council, members of the council, could be in direct communication with this large group. For this inaugural year of the fund.
Yeah. So, Wade, and then Scott.
Tom, I got to tell you, I really appreciate the invitation. And I always get concerned, though, whenever we get a direct invitation from a particular group, that did the Chickadee Society get a chance to be there as well, and were the Robin people and the Dove Society and the Trappers, and did everybody else have the same opportunity? If not, then we have to potentially open the doors for another future date where other people would have the same opportunity to invite us. So therefore, then if we don't attend to those, then we're discriminating against the first group that invited us. So as much as I appreciate it, I think you'd be maybe better if you held your meeting anyway and just let everybody know that you're holding it, and those who decide to show up could, and no direct invitation.
Scott?
And that was my question. If we determine that we got an invitation and that the council's going to go, and we encourage council members to attend, and that's one. Or if we say, here's what's going on, if you want to go, go. Okay, one is kind of a directive, one's kind of a, just kind of a, hey, for your information kind of deal. If we leave that open to the council that says, hey, there's this thing going on, if you want to go, go, you know, and is that different than saying this? I mean, do we present ourselves differently than if we say, hey, we're trying to organize as many people to show up as possible?
Scott, I think, just personally, that the difference is if we have an official meeting of the council. And I think that would be a problem for the reasons that have been raised, the perception, whether, you know, from any camp. Where does it end? Wayne, you bring up a good point. Where does it stop? But the information, I do think, that comes out of that process, regardless of any council members show up, will be very valuable, just as is. I know other groups at this hour are meeting to do the very same thing, to identify priorities and to bring that information to the council. It can be in written form, could be presentations. That's something we're going to be talking about. So my expectation is that, you know, the information that comes out of that will be helpful at a subsequent council meeting as part of our input process.
If I could get to Wayne's point about attendance as well, it was our expectation we use the DNR roundtable mailing list or the council's mailing list as an invite list to this function. So we're not trying to target one subset, if you will. It would be an open meeting, but the beginning point for the mailing list is the folks who are already on the roundtable, because they're going to be there anyways.
Darby?
Yeah, I certainly understand the complications here, but I'll tell you, the first meeting that we had, it was very clear that I think, if not a consensus close to that, the folks felt really strongly we need to do some listening. And I've looked at the calendar between now and April 1, and I think, and I strongly support the notion of listening opposed as well. How do we effectively do that in the time frame that we've got? this thing at least offers us a chance to hear a bunch of those people, but to really listen, it seems to me, you got to think about, okay, we got to go to Grand Rapids, and we got to go to Thief River Falls, and we got to go to Marshall, and we've got to go to Winona, and we've got to go to Worthington. Wow, when are we if that were all we were going to do between now and April 1, fantastic. But so anyway, that we can get some of that input, some of that listening to happen, is clearly an important thing for us, simply because of, among other things, the time problem that we've really got. I see us having a very serious time problem to really effectively listen.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'm struggling with seeing a distinction between what Mr. Landwehr's meeting that he and others are host are having amongst themselves and the DNR roundtable. Attendance by the council members at the DNR roundtable, where the individuals and the council members would receive information, might arguably be a council meeting. And it's happening whether we're going there or not. I think I've heard Mr. Landwehr say that they are likely to have this meeting regardless of whether council members, one or none, attend. So I'm struggling to see the distinction between any of those. I guess if these folks want to meet, it's a free world.
Dave?
Well, I think the issue is our staff has apparently been working on figuring out whether we can come. And that's different than Tom inviting us to an information meeting that we show up at or not. You know, what's the role of the council versus what's the role of us as individuals who want to learn something? It's a fine distinction. But I think it's one we've got to be really careful of, because we're all going to have opportunities to go to lots of different meetings, and we'll all go to different ones, and that's fine. But I don't think the staff wants to coordinate that for all of us every time there's an opportunity.
Mr. Chair,
Les.
I think we're missing a great opportunity if we do not have some type of representation at the DNR roundtable. Right now, our status has been innuendo and whoever catches the information that's going on and what's printed in the press. I think it gives us an opportunity to express where we're at as a council. Maybe, Mr. Chair, Mike, you should be doing this at the roundtable. I think we also have to use some good common sense. This is a good organization to be interfacing with. It's going to be a good exchange of ideas, and we can't necessarily be bound by something that doesn't exist in the law. I don't think this is a violation of the open meeting law. I think it's a good session of communication that's going to be necessary, and it'll be a good step to communicate with that 450, 500 people of where we're at, where we're going, and then go from there.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, just final point is I think we're really talking about the difference between 6 and 7 on a legal basis, if we have any concern on the open meeting law, right?
That's correct.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, again, I think this is such an important group that I would welcome the council's discussion at some point in the future about how to do an annual interface with this group, because, I think this is a hugely important constituency. I see you guys sort of at the top of the pyramid. You know, the bottom of the pyramid is all Minnesotans, the middle is the voters that voted yes, and then above that is this activist community of conservationists that are doing the work that you're going to be funding. And it's just critically important, I think, to have that active, ongoing dialogue between you, the decision makers, and the folks who are really supporting the efforts.
Dave?
And Tom, mm-hmm. I absolutely agree with that. I think my question is, who should organize it? And I think, ultimately, it should be our responsibility to organize a meeting of the people that we want to hear from, so that it is it's seen from afar as impartial versus... You know, I love the work you guys do, but I don't ever want to be accused of being, you know, showing favoritism because you got me to a meeting somewhere. And that's my...
Ron and I were at a meeting this morning. The Minnesota Environmental Initiative hosted a meeting, a legislative policy meeting. I mean, I can't imagine a group in Minnesota that does not have a legislative policy meeting about this time of year. And perhaps it's because there's not a quorum issue with something like that, but there are these hosted events all the time when there's those listening sessions. Farm Fest, apparently. There's all kinds of.
That's whether our staff is working on it.
No, too.
Well, let me just ask a question. If we had 7 of our members show up at the DNR roundtable, do we have a problem? And not even mentioning this meeting that you're proposing?
Well, that's a really good question, and I don't think I can answer that. Bill, can you answer that question?
All I know is that if you have a quorum and you're making decisions or receiving information, it constitutes a meeting, under my understanding of the law. So what's really interest here in a meeting like the roundtable is whether that constitutes purposefully going out to receive information. You know, this is a matter of trying to follow the intent of the law, which is to ensure that the public understands what's going on with regard to these public bodies. And that's all I can really say about it, Senator Anderson. I do know that if a meeting broke out at the roundtable, we would have trouble. If people started making decisions. I trust that we're smart enough not to do that.
Well, I would, and I just want to say that I also would love the opportunity to get this level of input. I think it's a wonderful idea, and I wish I could go to the roundtable, but I have some conflicts on Friday, all day Friday, so I wasn't planning to attend. But I think that given the law, and the reason for the law is a good reason, it does make sense that if we are to be invited or attend as a council, it should only be on our own terms. It should be as a meeting planned and scheduled and noticed by the council. Whether it's at the roundtable or at your event, it would be, well, it would be a council event, not your event, if it was something to follow the law, I believe. So, so honestly, I think we just need to make our own decisions about attending various meetings, and I just and to be on the safe side and not have it be any kind of council business unless we decide that we want to hold a meeting and then follow the proper procedures to do that.
Great. Wayne and then Scott.
We never did talk about whether I think everybody received an invitation at the roundtable meeting, but yet we didn't ever find out whether it's a sanctioned meeting, basically, by the council. And if it is, then it's one of those things where this goes into our budget. Mm-hmm. How many meetings will we go to? Because if you're going to say, yes, we may go, then we better be prepared to be paying the overnight expenses and everything else. If this one, again, is one that we're going to say, yes, we can go, then I guess we're going to be more mileage and another night overnight. Pretty soon, I'm not too sure our budget can support too many of these things. So I think a distinction has to be made is, even to start with, is the roundtable a meeting which we are authorized to attend for us to hear, get input? And then secondly, if that one is, then how about the one that Tom has put forth? I mean, you just, I think it's almost a decision from the chair.
Yeah.
Is which one shall we attend?
Yeah, and just in response to that, Wayne, my interpretation is that that would be something you would do on your own and that it would not be reimbursed through council because it's not a formal sanctioned council event. That's right.
And we have no money.
Well, that's a minor point as well. Scott.
My question was answered.
Yeah. Rick?
Mike, would have you talked with DNR about the possibility of you speaking on the agenda?
I haven't talked to them about that. They've talked to me about that. And they have
listening?
Asked.
You were listening.
Yeah, and I guess I agreed to do that. They're going to put some event on, I believe it's Friday afternoon, and I'm not sure any of the details, but they asked if I would represent the council at that venue on Friday afternoon. And so I plan to be there. I plan to be there as a person on Thursday, again, scheduling permitting to listen to what's being said, but not in obviously an official capacity of some council meeting, which as an individual.
And when we get to items 8 and 9 on the agenda, it may be possible by January 7th that we would know the dates and times and locations for listening sessions so that can be presented to the folks that are there.
Scott or Rick, that's our hope is that we will have, probably not today, but by the time we go to our next meeting, a schedule of what we plan to do, what our timelines are for those particular activities, including listening sessions. Yeah. Any other comments? I know that we're kind of moving into this item of our next discussion, but Tom, I guess you're hearing that you know a few members may participate on their own, but regardless, we think this is valuable input. It's certainly not the only source of input, but very helpful. And that regardless, we would like to have some written form summary of those priorities and strategies presented to the council.
We'll come up with a summary of the discussion that we had there and present that to the council.
Great.
Great.
Thank you, Tom.
Appreciate your hearing out and appreciate anybody who can make the event.
Great. Thank you.
Great.
Thanks, Tom. The next item is to talk about, it's really to open up the discussion. We, you know, the meeting we had 2 weeks ago was really perfunctory in terms of just getting acquainted with one another and getting a few things in order. What I want to do for the next hour or so is to really have a free-flowing discussion about how we plan to get, at least in the short term, our recommendations to the legislature by April 1. We're at about 115 days and counting now to do that. I know that Wayne has provided some of his thoughts on paper. Darby has as well. What I would like to do is to hear from everyone, and in no particular order, but we have staff that are recording and taking notes about what's being said, but I want to hear from all of you about a couple of things. One is, and we've been talking on the edges about this, what type of information do you as a council member and collectively a council do you think we need in order to get to that point of April 1st of having a first set of recommendations to the legislature? So what type of information? What's the format? This includes the things that has been things have been mentioned, like public input, listening sessions. Give me your thoughts about your thoughts about the role that public input and the types of information you need. Secondly, is give us some thoughts you have about a process you envision us going through between now and the end of March to get to that point of having some recommendations. And I guess the third thing I guess I'd ask you to think about is, and look in your crystal ball, what, as you look forward to these recommendations, do you see these recommendations more strategic in nature? You know, you look at the constitutional amendment says that, you know, protect, preserve, and enhance prairies, wetlands, forest, and let's say calm aquatic systems. Do you see the recommendations dealing strategically with allocating money amongst those areas? Do you see it more tactically about certain parcels that are priorities? So give me a sense of kind of what level of discussion you see those recommendations coming from. And what I've asked staff to do is to take good notes, and I've got a suggestion at the end of this discussion for moving us forward, because we don't have, you know, and as much as we'd love to and we really need some time to talk about this, and, you know, in an ideal world that might mean several meetings, we need to start moving forward. But to get that process rolling, I'd like to open the discussion, again, recognizing that what we talk about as a process between now and April 1st is very likely going to be different than a process that we establish on a more enduring timeline of getting recommendations on an annual basis. We just need to jumpstart the process to get rolling over the next 115 days or so, or 110 days. So with that, I'll open it up. Again, some thoughts about information needs you have, process you see us going through, and kind of the notion of what your vision of what these recommendations might look like at a very broad level or more specific. And with that, I'll just open it up.
Les? I'll start it, Mr. Chair. We've been looking at this for quite a while, and our thought process was, how do you look at the diversity of the state, the geological diversity of the state, because what occurs up in the northeast is going to be totally different than occurs down in the southwest. And there are some, I spent all day yesterday with the DNR, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and with NRCS, just looking at how these plans have already been distributed and how they've been split up in the state. And I just got the maps yesterday, but I will eventually make additional copies and split them up along the geological distribution. We have all the areas within the state represented by the major organizations, Ducks Unlimited, Pheasants Forever, Wild Turkey, the DNR, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, FSA, NRCS, and NRCS has in place now today in every region within the state the administrative procedures for implementing the permanent easements, conservation easements, and an agency that we've worked with quite extensively over the last 20 years. I think we're going to have to split the state up in the geological regions to look at the diversity of the state, and then identify those committees within those regions to bring the information to us. We've got a lot of low-hanging fruit on the trees of projects that have been in the mill. The only thing they're missing is funding. In our region alone, we could consume the entire budget. But I think we have to get the inputs and from all the areas in the state and start organizing the state by getting those inputs together.
Other thoughts? Jim?
Mike, I guess I understand that this particular time period is going to probably operate a little different than in the future, but I mean, within the amendment, we have a couple of responsibilities that are already spent out, the Partners Program and the Forest Legacy. Don't we really have to get a skeletal framework of some kind as to how these programs are going to work before we can start bringing this information into them? Don't we have to have some type of structure as to how we're going to have these different entities work before we start bringing this information into them? I mean, because when they come to present it, I mean, it's going to have to fit into the parameters of these different programs. So I guess my question is, don't we have to put somewhat of a structure together here first before we start getting this input? I mean, how does this Partners Program work? Is it going to be limited by dollars? Is, you know, how are we going to structure that? The Forest Legacy portion, are we going to set a dollar amount on that this year? And you know, what are going to be the parameters of these basically three separate programs that we're going to have to administer here?
Members, thoughts on that suggestion that we might want to think about creating these framework for these different programs prior to actually identifying these strategies or even maybe getting input into the process.
Right.
Yeah. Dave and then Ellen.
Well, I would agree with that. I think there are some fundamental questions we have to ask ourselves before getting into what we're going to funding and establish some principles, I guess, of how we're going to operate. You know, things about permanence of easements versus temporary easements. I'm 100% behind doing nothing but permanent easements. But until we have that discussion as a council and make a decision, to talk about what we're going to fund seems premature to me. What are we going to do on forest legacy easements where the DNR, who likes to hold these easements, wants the ability to mine if there are recoverable minerals in there, which is a huge conflict, which we have to resolve before we decide to fund Forest Legacy anywhere. You know, what are we going to do, urban versus rural? How do we handle long-term stewardship and enforcement of conservation easements? There's a list of a number of things that I think we have to get clear with ourselves as to how any allocation of money is going to be governed by certain principles. And then we have to get to the more interesting detail of how do we allocate around the state in a fair way, given the priorities that we have to protect, enhance, and restore. And what do we do when, you know, there's a huge opportunity someplace that's one, you know, it's only going to come once in a while. And how do you break the rules for trying to make sure you don't leave out a part of the state when you have a really unique opportunity? So I think there's a whole series of discussions we have to have before we get to how are we going to decide on the money itself.
Okay. Ellen?
I like David's list of kind of big picture questions that we have to grapple with to set some standards in place. But I also think we need to, I don't want to start talking about which programs to fund yet until we step back and make really a strategic plan for what, you know, what is our job over the next 25 years, even though we're not going to be personally here for 25 years sitting at this table. God help us. we hope not. We need to set a plan in motion and sort of say, you know, what are the ecological goals that we need to meet to protect our prairies and our forests and our wetlands, et cetera. You know, I think we need to start with the science and the research that's been done, like the statewide conservation plan and the there's one called the conservation plan. What's your plan called? Mike, you have a plan that you worked on.
Well, that's that plan.
This plan.
And well, the governor's Conservation Legacy Council plan.
Yeah, that's what I mean. That plan and then the statewide conservation and preservation plan. Anyway, there's some plans that have been done, and there's a lot of research that's been done by smart people around the state. And I think we need to look at that, and we also need to listen to people around the state who really work on these issues on a day-to-day basis. But we need to sort of create the framework. What do we think can be accomplished with the public's money over the next 25 years? You know, here we are now, and what do we want the state to look like in 10 years or in 20 years or in 25 years when it comes to habitat? How much riparian land can be protected by these dollars, for example? Maybe we should set some numerical goals about how many miles of rivers and ditches need to be protected by buffers, and how do we prioritize which ones those are for the most habitat protection? You know, how many acres of prairie should we try to either acquire or restore? It's not necessarily all things that will come down to numbers, but that's part of it. And so I want to sort of do the big picture thinking before we start deciding how to funnel the money out to achieve those goals. We got to have goals in mind before we decide how to spend the money.
Thank you. Wait.
Mr. Chair, I think people have been sitting around for the last 12 years waiting to have a voice in how things happen in Minnesota. Resources are protected, how game and fish people and habitat and things get improved, and how people can be intentional in getting involved. And as we're trying to put this whole thing together, I see and I hear people just itching to have their day in court. They want to be able to speak their mind. I think one of the things is primary, while we're looking at all these plans that might be out there, they're all good. But remember, they're created by some entity of government, usually. There's regular citizens out there. They were the voters. Government didn't vote for this council or in this money. It was done by individuals who wanted to have their voices be heard. And so I think one of the first things we need to do is get something going on a more local basis in every county. And that's why I put a proposal together, just because I feel very strongly about the fact that we need counties, smaller areas, people to have an opportunity to go to an area and say, this is what's on my mind. And maybe that's the first time ever that the local communities will get a chance to hear from the government. This is a plan which is in place for areas. A lot of these people have never known that there is a plan in place. It's an opportunity for people on a countywide basis, a regional basis, to hear what the plans are out there. Let them be the ones that bring concerns to us and tell us what's most important to them. Then we can eventually act on what's the concerns of the people of Minnesota. Because there is no way we're going to hear from everybody from the northeast to the northwest, southeast, southwest with this group. And we'll talk about listening sessions. I think that's where the listening sessions have to happen. People have a direct voice. They can stand across from somebody else and say, this is what's going on in my county. This is what's going on in my neighborhood. Then expand from there, not from the top on down. We need to start this from the bottom up.
Darby?
Mike, in response to what I thought were Wayne's very helpful suggestions in what he wrote out, and I've spent some time thinking about just kind of supplementing some of the things that he's identified, and I put pen to paper, and I did just like to pass this around. It's just a single sheet, and you can take a look. It's just items for consideration, as it's entitled. Just suggested sequenced items kind of in some sort of reasonable chronological order. And as you can see, I mean, it really begins with, I think, with, as Wayne has said, is the listening sessions. I think that's where we begin. And then we, in item B under number one...
See, Darby, can we just wait till we get it around the table?
Okay.
Otherwise, we don't know what you're referring to. Thanks.
Yeah.
I think we're good now. Thanks.
Okay. And B essentially reiterates what's already been said. There are a lot of plans out there, and this is just simply a couple of them, but clearly there are others. It simply is our information gathering phase one, kind of to get our feet on the ground. The next would be really essentially what Ellen was commenting about, to establish an overall strategic plan so that we, among other things, could, and then I've just listed some things that I think the strategic plan would deal with. I think it is significant that we are important, that we ask, what do we want? In 25 years, this thing sunsets. What do we want the end product to be? Where do we want to be at the end of 25 years? And there's some items in there about, you know, do we want to get into establishing priorities where we maximize for every dollar spent what we get out of it. In C, establishing general acreage and shoreline footage targets so we know what we're shooting at. Are they going to be easements? Are they going to be just plain enhancements in other ways as to be part of our ultimate goals? I'm going pretty quickly through this, but I think you get an idea, and I don't present it as sort of comprehensive. It's just thoughts that occurred to me that we ought to be, I hope we're going to be at least considering. Determine our relationships with a number of other entities. The Clean Water Fund group, for heaven's sakes. Both what they do and what we do have considerable overlap, and I don't know what we see as our relationship. Are we going to basically ignore them? Are we basically going to ignore LCCMR, or are we instead going to Bowser and so forth, or do we see some sort of relationship some linkage, whatever. I don't know. It could take a lot of different forms. Not suggesting anything, just suggesting that at least we consider what that relationship ought to be, if any. I think Les was talking about geological systems in my item number four. As present in the Minnesota, statewide conservation preservation plan, wow, there are ecosystem subset boundaries that I think are ideal. That's really, I agree with you, Les. I think that's the kind of thing that we really need to be using as our resource areas. That's, I think pretty significant. Counties fall within those, certainly, so it's not to deny incorporation of counties into it. Item number six, do we want to encourage proposals to be directed at identified highest priority resource issues to maintain balance? What if the proposals that come are all, I don't know, wetlands? We do need to think about some sort of balance between, the deer hunting habitat as opposed to the duck hunting habitat and the aquatics and so forth. We may want to, when we send out our RFPs, say, we're interested for now in this and this. And then as time passes, we can say, okay, we're overbalanced somewhere. We really need to get back to supporting proposals that are a little bit other than what we've been seeing. 7-8, establish a clear, easily understood project ranking process. I think that's going to be a very important step that as we proceed, we're going to want. Certainly establishing a fair, equitable, and thorough review process of all proposed projects. Again, just a thought, given our incredibly cramped time frame, maybe we want to, as Les suggested, seek out projects that are already on the shelf to implement this first round. That clearly would change. I see this first round as being maybe a bit different than what ultimately will happen, simply because of the time situation we're in. So anyway, for what it's worth, and I apologize for not getting it to you earlier. I know I appreciate Wayne having done that. And
Thank you. Others? Yeah, Rick?
I think one of the practical challenges we have is April 1st may be too late, because there are going to be committee deadlines, and we're going to be operating. We can't assume that we're not operating without the context of the $5 billion shortfall and federal stimulus package for shovel-ready projects. And that's going to be a given that's going to be there. I think we may have to have recommendations before the House and Senate committee deadlines to get in to that process. I'm not sure if April 1st is after or before. So that accelerates the things, which may mean that we have to do things in this first round different than in the second.
I think with transparency and input, we should make sure the web page can take comment immediately. Maybe we want to look at having an 800 number to take comment. We've had in the legislature a property tax comment line that I know people have called in with ideas, and you get good ideas from the public, because not everybody will be able to make a meeting. Those of us who go to all kinds of meetings, there's not that many people who go to meetings because they've got work or whatever and schedules. So we have to be able to get input, not in the traditional meeting format. That's not to say we don't do meetings, but you have to be able to draw as much comment or information in as possible. And then I think we have to look at where we where there are projects that are ready to go, where there are projects that have a ripple effect that help our economy out, in addition to helping the resource during these times. And ultimately, we've got to get a bill through the legislature, and we've got to get that passed and not have it taken apart in the committee process or taken apart on the floor. So balance is going to be important, regional and ecological, because we've got to get people to vote for it and not say, how come there's not anything in my area? And then if you say the bigger picture is we've got a real jewel here that we've been able to either obtain or restore or protect, that'll help out. Those are, I don't believe we can stress enough the reality of passing this bill through the legislature and the timeline that will be needed in the context of the budget that we will be facing. And we're going to have to be real clear on providing some questions about supplant or supplement as we move forward.
Others of you that haven't shared your thoughts.
Yeah, Wes?
Just continuation. We've got a lot of plans out there right now. And from planning to implementation is a big step. I think the first thing we're going to have to look at is make some financial projections on what funds are going to be available for the next year. The funds that are going to be available for next year probably won't be in time to do any major construction projects, but they sure could start. We could start looking at funding the easement projects such as RIM CREP, which is totally void of funds right now. And there's many, many projects that are sitting in the mill for those two major projects. On the overlay of this map, we overlaid the major watersheds, the river districts, and it gets to be a very, very complicated element when you, as you start breaking it down. Every one of these river districts, every one of these counties has a very, very thorough, detailed plan of the sensitive areas that already exist, the planned preservation areas that the only thing we're missing is funding. And I think there's a lot of projects out there that in the next 18 months we're going to be looking at a relatively opportune time frame also with the decrease in land prices and the increased value of the easements that we could potentially look at in that area. So to study or create a new plan is a major undertaking when the plans are already in existence, and really we have to start looking at implementation of those plans and identify which of those plans we want to implement.
You know, just on that point, Les, 2 weekends ago I spent a little time on that very point looking at the plans that exist, whether it be a waterfall plan or a WMA acquisition plan or a restoration plan, whatever. And I was very pleasantly surprised, number one, that those plans not only exist, but they're very current. Most of them have been within the last 2 years. Several have been within the last year. Secondly, that they weren't just developed by the Department of Natural Resources, but they really were a collaboration of lots of different partnerships, whether it be Pheasants Forever or DU or whoever, Minnesota Deer Hunters. And the third thing, which I thought was very useful, was there was on almost every plan not only priorities, but also some very measurable goals over the next 20, 40, whatever. Their timelines were different. But a lot of that information we've been talking about exists out there, and it's really a matter of bringing that information to the council and really using that as a context for us identifying where we want to go. So it's not like we have to reinvent the wheel. You're absolutely right. There are a lot of very good plans, at least from my perspective, that exist and have the types of information we're looking for to help us do our job. Bob?
Mr. Chair, a couple things I was just thinking about here is, I agree with Les on the, we need to figure out how much money we got to spend. I think that's one of our first primary interests. I know in the handouts that Bill gave to us earlier, we have $78,500,000. That's roughly the expected fund revenue for the next fiscal year. If you peel off of that, the 1% for administrative fees, or excuse me, administrative costs that we would have, that probably leaves you in the $77 million, a little over $77 million range. And by the way, we'd have to take a portion of that administrative money and pay back the DNR. So from an operating standpoint, we're not going to be able to operate on $780,000. We're actually going to operate on significantly less because of the payback provision that we have. But I think it's right, we should probably set up how much money are we going to spend, and also be mindful not just of the administrative costs, but I think there's a reserve component that I think is, from a policy standpoint, is important for the council to consider. We all have seen the budget projections drop shorter than what was originally proposed. The legislature is going to have to deal with $470-something million shortfall in this biennium. That's a big challenge for him. I would hate for us to be in a circumstance either next year or sometime in the future making commitments to folks that we can't live up to. So especially in these first few years, I think there might be some consideration to establishing a reserve that is appropriate, whatever that might be, in some formula, 3%, 5% of whatever it is, but something so that we maintain, I think, our primary principle, one of our fundamental principles is to protect the taxpayers and our commitments that we have with folks. So I think establishing a budget makes sense. When I look at the Constitution, and I frame up my thinking on how to target this based on that. That is our mission statement, preservation, enhancement, and restoration. Those are activities, preservation, enhancement, and restoration. And then we have targets, prairies, wetlands, forest land. So if you frame a matrix up, we have nine boxes. So we have enhancement of prairies, restoration of forest land. So theoretically, we have nine boxes in a matrix that is consistent with the mission established in the Constitution. So we could organize our thinking perhaps on those nine boxes. I'm not saying that they are equal in weight. We may judge that they're not, but they are clearly in the Constitution as part of our mission. And however we organize that matrix and funding formulas for them, either on a short-term or long-term basis, the end result must be to improve habitat for game, fish, and wildlife. That's, again, in the Constitution. That's the end goal. So I think part of our challenge is to set a budget, set an asset allocation model. The concept for me is an asset allocation model, and each one of those is sort of an asset class, as you might have in investment strategies, because we really are investing. And so that's how I frame things up. So if you're asking me what's the information, it's a budget, some kind of an asset allocation model based on the Constitution, and then incorporating on a strategic basis how we use the plans that exist, because I think there is the value there. Thanks, Bob.
Mr. Chair, just on strategic plans and strategic availability, I think we're in a very opportune stage right now with forest fragmentation problem. That's the one that's critical. It's happening right now. The window of opportunity is slowly closing on us, and it will not be solvable in a couple of years. That land is being sold off as we speak. The opportunity that we have is the market is down. It's slowed in a sense, so we may not have to look at the entire state, or we may not be able to look at the entire state for an equal distribution of these funds. We may have to concentrate on one area where the critical nature of the problem exists now and budget and plan for the intervention in that area. So that's one major area that may not create an equal distribution of funds throughout the state. The next go-around, we may take a look at a different area within the state.
Other thoughts? Yeah, Bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to throw a thought here, we've had a lot of great ideas, and we've got the input from the folks that have dealt with the LCCMR and whatnot, but there was some earlier discussion, I think, by Bob, about bringing in somebody from Missouri. Has that been thrown out of the discussion? You know, we have, and when I listen to Rick, we don't have much time either. We have to get our plans together and get it into the legislature. But Has that been talked about at all?
Bill?
Chair Mike, Bill. We made contact. They're willing to come when we say come.
Great.
Can we, Mr. Chair, can we pay for that? Can we pay for that on our out of our loan? I mean, is there enough money to get them?
I believe so.
Presuming.
So long as they don't come first class.
Yeah.
Just as a point, we brought representatives from Missouri up as part of the Conservation Legacy Council process, and we found that to be a very, very helpful dialogue, understanding not that they have all the answers, but the model they put in place is certainly very different than ours, and it has some really good success stories, and I think it would be something we could benefit from. It's a matter of when we would do that, and you know, do we do it at, we do it at the expense of something, and the question is, when would we do that best?
There are other state programs that are worth looking at.
Mr. Chair?
Too.
Yeah. Hey, Bill and
just one more. Just one more. Throw it out on the table for discussion in the interest of transparency of this group. There was a lot of talk about going to the roundtable discussion and whether we should go to that and how many of us should go. And I look at it as a learning opportunity, certainly for myself. And I'm sure others do as well. But during the interim here, I'm getting a lot of calls personally at home. Would you come out and look at this? Would you come out and look at that? I have actually went out and done that. Do you see any benefit? And maybe I'm wrong doing that. I hope I'm not. But I'm going out and I actually went with a tour of the DNR and federal folks out on the Western Prairies. I looked at some of the projects they were doing so I can understand what they talk about when it comes forward. Is there any benefit of keeping a log of that so this group, maybe on the website, when people say, "Well, you're not even coming out talking to us." Yes, we are. Here's what Senator Anderson did 1 month. She actually went to two or three different seminars. Les and myself went here or there. Is there any benefit to that, or is that creating another monster?
I think there is some.
It's creating a monster.
I think both.
Yes.
I do think there is some benefit, Bill, because
obviously the parties sitting here are interested in doing that already, and that'd be a good response back to the public, I guess. So.
Well, just on that very point, 15 minutes before I left to come over here, I got an email from a colleague of mine who lives 300 miles away in Minnesota, and this person's comment was, "Well, how do I get access to this?" And it looks like this is an insider game. He didn't use those words, but the impression was, "I want to be part of this. I want to have access. How am I going to be able to interface? And what are you doing to reach out? And to the extent we can document those, I think it would help." Wayne, and then Jim.
When I sat on the along with Bob on the LCMR. Task force before we recreated it to be the LCCCMR, we went through and had the listening sessions from all these other organizations that also had plans in place. Missouri, I think we paid them a couple thousand dollars to come up and talk to us. We had Arts Council, a number of them, just about anybody we could think of that had something unique and different. And what we came up with was a process that's now the LCCCMR. There was 18 people, I think, involved in that process. I looked at every one of them and came up with something. So when we keep talking about we don't want to reinvent the wheel, a lot of the stuff, the footwork is already done in order to create that. The first group I would like to hear from is the LCCMR and find out exactly how it's working, what was developed by those people, because what's already there may be what we want to model again, and maybe we want to take what's there and tweak it. So.
Thank you. Jim?
Well, again, when people are out there and they talk to me, the first thing they want to know is how does this program work? And until we can tell them, we can go on these listening sessions and so on and so forth, but until we can tell them how this program works, what value does it have? All these people that are out there talking, if there was a process where they could start entering these projects or whatever into the system, that would eventually work their way to us. That's the only way we're really going to do it. We can't go out and speak to everybody in the state of Minnesota. We've got to have a process on how this system works. I think everyone agrees this first go-around is going to be a little different than long-term, but maybe that's the first thing we ought to do is address how we're going to operate at least this first session so we can go out and explain to these people and get them involved in the system so there's a process to become part of this.
Other thoughts? One of the things I guess I'd like to hear a little bit more detail from you on is this notion of input. know, a number of people talk about listening sessions or public input, recognizing that we have a deadline that's looming. Give me a sense of how you might see that unfold. Are you, would the council be, for example, comfortable with, we've had a couple of ideas. One is, you know, creating a website where people can provide public input. We can create listening sessions, you know, in different parts of the state. Another option could be we could, as a council, we could break into groups and maybe try and go out and get input. I mean, I'm trying to look at ways in which we can efficiently do our work, and I don't see this as linear in the sense that we have to stop everything until we're done listening. I think, Jim, you're absolutely right. We need to create this framework, but at the same time, we could possibly be getting some of that input from the groups that are involved with the Nature Conservancy and others. But so give me a sense of kind of public input, where you see that going. Dave?
Well, my sense is that, you know, the model that the LCCMR has used in terms of having field trips to go out and see projects and understand the opportunities is a good one. And it's also a great opportunity to get public input to the whole group. I don't see any way that we're going to accomplish the work that we have to do in this short period of time and have an agenda of going out and getting public input at the same time. And I would bet if you look at all of the plans that are out there, there is so much public input that's gone into all of those plans to get them to the point they are, that we can get by without with an April 1st deadline without having much public input as a formal process. And then as we have a little more time, look for how we can do that better going forward. I just don't see how we can possibly have an agenda of a lot of public input in the next couple of months and get all the other work that we have to do done.
Wayne, and then Les.
I think you're absolutely correct. If we're going to get anything done, I think it almost going to come down to a point where we need to hear a narrative of all the plans that are out there. And this group has to sit down and just pick one for the first time out and say, we're going to expend this many dollars or this percent of the money, have some carryover so we can get into the next year. Let's get off and running on a good foot. And let everybody know that it's not over. That's just initially until we can have enough time to put it all together. After that, I think the opportunity, we have Bowser in Minnesota, which is county-based. And they already are pretty knowledgeable about what's going on in every one of the counties in Minnesota. They also have their districts and their associations they work with. I think there's another good opportunity there for them to help us with our listening sessions.
Wayne, just on that point, I received an email from the executive director of Bowser about a week ago or less, saying that they are currently in the process of holding 7 listening sessions all around the state to get input for us on conservation priorities for our benefit. And the invitation was, you know, would you like that information? Of course, I couldn't type fast enough. Send it our way. So, Wayne, on that point, those types of initiatives are underway. I know the Department of Natural Resources and others are also doing those sorts of things. So that will all be very helpful information to the process. Sorry to interrupt.
No, just that's okay. Well, I happen to work in an office where the soil and water is next door. And so I asked them, I said, what would be the potential for you helping us out and getting some of this information? And they said, just say the word and we'll start out a pilot project. And so it sounds like every county almost was prepared to give them a chance. They'll go out and find some information for us. And so that might be the way we want to start our local listening sessions, is let them do the legwork. They already have a board. They already have a board. They've already talked to people locally. Then let them bring their concerns maybe up the ladder and see which counties have similar concerns. You might be surprised on how many of them can put some good projects together.
Les?
I would echo those same sentiments. A lot of that filtration has already been done. There's the summary that we could attain, and I know by April 1st is a stringent deadline, but we can't afford not to meet that deadline. Mm-hmm. Failure is not an option here, but I think we have to have a plan together. It may not be the final polished plan that will operate in the future, but I think we have to get this thing off and running.
Other thoughts on public input? I guess a question I would also like to have us think about and talk about is this proposal request process. I mean, people have referred to the LCCMR model, And I'm somewhat familiar with it, but not all that. And I guess I would defer to Bill or Rick or Ellen, people who've been involved, or Dave. You know, that's a very time-consuming process. And so just give us a couple minutes of, from a practical standpoint, Dave, as a member, given the magnitude of funding we have to deal with, and if we were to adopt a model like that process, I mean, what timelines are we talking about?
Not timelines we're going to meet.
Okay.
The LCCMR process is it's very rigorous. It's incredibly time-consuming for the LCCMR itself. And I don't think ultimately it's as efficient as it could be. I think we have a real opportunity to key in on a particular issue in a particular region that we want to prioritize, and there are plenty of organizations and agencies that can run grants programs to accomplish that, where we don't have to sit in judgment of every single program that comes down the pike. We'd be far better off to set priorities and set criteria for selection and then hold people accountable for the selection. One of the huge problems with the LCCMR, in my opinion, today is when the priorities are developed early in the year, nobody's willing to say, and this is how much money goes to that priority. So what you have is, at the end, you've heard 100 proposals. Now let's start dividing up the money with nothing in terms of how much is going to this versus this versus this, and not that we come out with bad recommendations as we're doing it, but we don't come up with as strong recommendations, and we don't have the diligence of process of saying we're going to have a scoring system, and by God, the scoring system rules this to some degree. You want some flexibility. So I think it's... we can be a lot more efficient. It's harder within the LCCMR because the charge is much broader. And so you've got, you know, a pull between this priority and that priority. Our pull is going to be between prairies and forests. It's not going to be between climate change and conservation easements. And so I don't think we have the same issues. So I'd like to see us figure out how to do this in a much more streamlined process than the LCCMR does.
And
we'd all be more sane if we did.
And Dave, just to give a sense of the timelines, what generally are you talking about for the process that you just described? Is that a 2-month, 3-month?
Well, from the time the RFP goes out until the hearings start is probably 3 months. And then the hearings, you know, we winnow the group a little bit. This year we had two tranches, continuing projects and sort of new initiatives. I think we had 4 full days of hearings of proposals by the time it was done. And, you know, it's one of the things that we've struggled with is sort of asking people to put proposals together during the field season. Really hard to have an RFP due in the end of August when everybody's out in the field working the projects at the same time. It's not such a big deal for land acquisition. It's a huge deal for restoration type projects. But, you know, what we did this year is we broke that up, you know, into our continuing projects and our new initiatives, which means that we weren't fresh on everything when we came right down to it because we were several months apart. And we still didn't have the allocation figured out until the last day. And I will tell you, I chaired the meeting, and it wasn't a lot of fun the last day with a clean slate and $75 million worth of requests and $25 million worth of money and no criteria to figure out where we start. We can do better by doing the tough work up front in terms of where are we going to allocate.
Other thoughts?
I think just...
Bob?
I'm sorry.
No, it's okay.
I was just going to say, I think I'm mindful of all the scheduling issues here and Rick's recommendation that we be considerate of the legislative schedules and so forth. I think we, I'll just, as a straw man, suggest that we probably need to figure out how much money we have and on a categorical basis, if we adopt this matrix consideration, I think we probably need to make those decisions in very early January, so that to allow the folks that are going to apply for these the opportunity and time to put things together. And I would say we could take the month of February, so to solicit and begin to review for final decision by, you know, middle of March at the latest.
Rick?
I think one model, and it's not a perfect model, but if we think of what we're doing as investments, there's the capital investment process. You know, we're looking at things that have a permanency, or they have some type of, they're not the additional study, they're not another plan, they're an asset to the state. So if we look at what we're looking for as far as assets and how we achieve those, and it's not a perfect process in terms of you get divided between environmental and education and all the other capital projects. But here you're taking capital projects and almost dividing them among different types of resources according to the Constitution. And so I like what you had said about the matrix, but I think if we think about these as capital investments, it might give us a better context of putting it together, and that can get put together. And there's kind of a role, and maybe we have the capital investment committees just talk about that rolling cycle that they do of projects that go out. And some of them do maybe take some design preparation, or they're phased over 2 years and 4 years and 6 years. But there's a project that's there that's ongoing, and the projects get allocated, and the next year they get put in. And so there's a rolling cycle there that maybe one portion of this money or a larger portion of it. But for the short term, we may want to look at these as capital investments and try to get that as through. And that also adds to matching federal dollars, being able to get projects in the ground, which I think we need to get some projects in the ground.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, on this,
yeah, well,
I think I think part of what we're hearing here is kind of process orientation. Then we're starting, I think it's kind of requirements. Some of the things that we would require, matching grant. You know, if we could keep track of what were some of the requirements. All right, we're going to place a higher value on those people who will say, you know, we've got five different partners, and for every dollar you use, we're going to match it with five. That sounds like it makes sense if it's consistent with those asset classes that we're thinking about. So that's our criteria to consider. Competency. Is the organization, have they done this before? You know, do we have confidence in them? Can they show us projects where they've done it? Do they have audit standards and requirements in place so that we can ensure that the money is used properly? We'll need to make some decisions about easements. Which way direction are we going? How do we handle the issue of taxes? How do we handle the issue of local governments? I think we want to be sure that the projects are have been ideally brought before the county boards and adopted, and so that the no net loss issue has already been addressed, so we're not in an awkward circumstance. But I think these are kind of requirement issues that are secondary to these. How much money?
Les,
if I could take a real project and just go through a little bit of the phasing that's already in existence, it's on the drawing boards. Let's talk about the Christina Lake project. Small club put it together, cost sharing through Pheasants or Ducks Unlimited. It's about $1 million project. The engineering has been done on it. The design is already in place. The costing has already been done. It's a matter of funding. Now, a lot of this has already gone through the existing processes of NRCS, the DNR, Ducks Unlimited. So a lot of the legwork has been done, and I think we would be hard-pressed to try to duplicate that effort. The political ramifications have been taken care of as far as the associated input from the other surrounding areas and everything. The county has been interfaced with as far as the approval, and this is a multi-county area. So a lot of this legwork at the local level has been pretty much done. Now, when that project is submitted, it's going to be submitted to us. Here's what it's costing. Here's what the effect is going to be. Do we want to approve it? So
those situations I think are going to be multiplied many, many times over in the state, and let's utilize those functions that already exist and utilize the expertise out there, because there's some pretty smart people working on those projects, and we may come to the conclusion that we're not going to fund it, but that becomes the upper decision that I think we have to make in comparing it with the rest of the projects. So,
other thoughts? Yeah.
First of all, it's very unfortunate the LCCMR isn't working out the way it's supposed to, or at least it's cumbersome now. That I can guarantee you the discussion was at that point, keep it simple. And what happened after we got done with it, I don't know. But let's look at this one, and I would like to go reiterate again. Let's keep this simple. This shouldn't be one of those things that you have to hire somebody to a grant writer to be able to put something together. In some cases, it might be a benefit, and somebody that knows on somebody knows what's going on with them. However, I think there's a point here where we need to get back, like we just got through talking, we start calling each other by first names. Let's get this thing simple and say, does it look good? Does it sound good? If it is, it probably is. And then let's do it. There's a point here where if we don't keep it simple, will the whole bureaucracy overshadow the projects? People won't even know what we're talking about. And that happens sometimes with just the language that we put into this thing. If people can't understand what we're all about and what we're talking about, they won't know how to apply. So if we could try to keep this really, really simple, ABC, that'd be great.
Other thoughts?
Just one quick comment. Our statutory directive has also been that we are going to make sure that the smaller organizations within the state have the ability to share these funds. This hasn't been necessarily popular with some people, but we're going to have to make it easy enough and simple enough where the small organization, the Coots Unlimited organization, has the capability of getting an RFQ in and getting it approved if it's a good project. If we layer it with a lot of bureaucracy, we're going to get a lot of static from the people of the state of Minnesota as to the complication of the bureaucracy that we've created. So, again, as Wayne echoed, keep it simple.
Other thoughts?
Well, I think we ought to be aware of existing grant programs that we can allocate money to that can do our work for us instead of us having to do it all ourselves. There are plenty of those types of programs that can get the money to where we want it without us having to do all of the work. And we can do the work of saying, this is the criteria by which we want you to give away money to the things that are most important to us. Get it done. And that's ultimately far more efficient than us duplicating a process that already exists. And that's one of the ways to get to some of the smaller groups, is to fund some of the grant programs that don't have any money today.
Sounds like a criteria. Yeah.
So it's a strategy.
Yeah. Let me propose. Oh, Bob.
I'm sorry. Mr. Chair, just one last thing. I think we want to be able to look for those projects that have clearly articulated outcomes that are consistent with habitat for game, fish, and wildlife.
Yep.
I'd like to know, how many ducks do you have right now? How many will you have when this project is done? Mm-hmm. If you can't tell me that, if you don't have to answer the first question, I don't know that you're going to be able to answer the second one.
Depends on how many you shoot when you're an island.
Yeah, well, that's right. Zero.
Mr. Chair, and don't overlook the possibility that some of these results are very immeasurable.
Of course, yeah.
I think we're all touching on parts of our criteria that would like to see in one of the most highly ranked projects.
Yeah, David. Let me suggest that by the next meeting, we all need to think about the criteria that we think is important, that we need to have a discussion about and start resolving it. You know, mine is, are we doing permanent or temporary easements? But we all have, and you know, we've seen some stuff from Darby and Wayne. We ought to just create the bullet points of big picture issues that we need to start addressing to get us to that place, which would include the criteria by which we're going to judge proposals.
So on that point, David, let me make a suggestion. I think that's a good one, and that was along the lines of what I was going to suggest. What I'm looking for are some volunteers that between now and the next meeting of the council, which we'll talk about in a bit, can do a couple things. They can help start creating this framework, which includes the notes I have, these outcomes or goals that we're talking about, these principles for this framework, the criteria by which we will evaluate the outcomes as well as the projects, and for ranking priorities or identifying priorities. Secondly, there's another key element, which is this notion of information needs and more specifically public input. What proposed process do we see? We've heard lots of different ideas about how we might do that. That cat can be skinned lots of different ways. And the third one is we need to get real about this, folks, which means with both the framework and public input and a process for reviewing and making decisions through a matrix approach or whatever, we need some timelines associated with that. So if that's agreeable to you, what I'm looking for is a group of volunteers. We can create an ad hoc committee. Short of that, we can use our governance committee that we already have that would come back to the next council meeting with a proposed framework, kind of process for getting us through public input or information needs, a process of reviewing projects, and something we can work over, but we have something, a straw man on paper that we can either adopt or modify just as we do with the protocols. But time is short, and I think we need to move on this now. And so that would be what I would propose. So comments, suggestions on that?
Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Les.
I would suggest that it be an action item for the Governing Council and expand that to any other volunteers that would like to participate.
Okay, great. So if I don't think we need a motion on that, I guess since we adopted our procedures, the chair would ask that the Governance Council meet. Bill and staff are taking good notes that this governance committee come back with a proposed structure, the framework, the things we talked about, public input process and timelines to get us from where we are to where we need to be April 1. What else?
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Bill.
Are we going to be looking at hiring pretty soon? I mean, staff?
That was my next point. I had in my notes I would like to establish a personnel committee, and I'm looking for volunteers, and that's something that I would like to move on before at least getting that committee together, because there are some things the committee needs to start thinking about. And so I guess at this point I'm looking for, if anyone has thought now about being a volunteer to serve on the personnel committee for the council, I would like to hear that, because I'd like to, if anyone's willing to volunteer, we can start putting together a committee. I don't see it's going to be a big one, but it's a very important one.
Jim? Mike, is this committee just going to do the executive director, or is it staff beyond that, or is it to decide what the structure is going to be, or what is it?
I think long-term it would have both responsibilities, all of both. Excuse me. Initially, it would be to get an executive director on board, but also identify a staffing plan. Bob?
I'd be happy to help.
Great. So Bob is willing to serve. Any other members? Otherwise, Jim? Okay.
I'm assuming it's subject to open meeting law again. You can't do it by phone.
Well, it is certainly subject to open meeting laws. However, there may be some things that are subject to closed meeting, particularly if it relates to hiring. I don't know. That's one of the first orders of business, to find out what things need to be done through open meeting, what things are prohibited by law.
I'd like to just make a comment, and I know it's probably out of order, but this is precisely, we've got a number of individuals who are concerned that, the Northeast and the Northwest and everything somehow aren't represented by the council. But the problem is everything is so far from each other and everything is subject to open meeting law. Unless you have a group which is close together, it's pretty difficult to do. Mm-hmm. Can't do it by the phone. So we're kind of stuck with, and once again, I'm one of those people that I like to watch the checkbook, and I hate to be the one driving 200 miles for a three-hour meeting and then just saying, now pay me. So I can see that lots of times this is going to have to be a closer-knit group.
Well, Wayne, I want to suggest that we figure out legislatively as part of an adjunct to our recommendations how we can fix that to allow telephone meetings. Public can listen in. There is a way to do it. We just need, we're going to be limited to some degree short term, but long term, you're right. We want participation of the folks who don't live just in the cities and can get here for a 2-hour meeting.
Thank you. Appreciate that.
Bill.
To the point, agenda item number 10, the memo that starts out, "Hello, Bill," does talk about some of the things we can do, including
interactive television meetings and limited use of telephone. And we have, if you would choose to meet at DNR, I know very good interactive TV facilities there, and I suspect the legislature has them too, somewhat. I'm not sure where.
Mr. Chair, just one other suggestion too. The webinars are becoming very, very popular. You got your PC in front of you, your telephone. Gary used it quite effectively when we were going through the initial processes here. So if you haven't been involved in it, it's very effective, very simple. All the facilities are there.
So just to recap, we're asking the Governance Committee of the Council to put together this framework, process for public input and timelines, come back to the Council at its next meeting with a proposal. We have a Personnel Committee consisting of Bob Schroeder and Jim Cox, and I would look at least for a third person, so think about that. Rick, you'd be willing to do that? That's great. And any others?
Well, I was going to say I think I'd like to join the Governance Council discussion.
Perfect.
On the other goals.
Of course.
You're saying that we're going to open that up.
So. Mm-hmm. Perfect. And so, I mean, this is not exclusionary by any means. So anyone who wants to be part of that process, that's great. They're all open meetings. So, Darby?
Yeah, I was just going to say essentially what Ellen did. I'd be happy to serve.
Great.
I'm a guidance committee as a part of that.
Very good. Great. Okay. So I think the three of that are on the Personnel Committee need to just check base after the meeting and talk about next steps for that. And also, Bill, if you could organize a meeting of the Governance Committee here in the next, shortly after Christmas, I would guess, so that we can get some information to the Council by their next meeting.
I will do my best.
Okay, which I think now moves us on to we've talked about 9. I think we need to talk about 10, which is our future meeting schedule. Given what we've just talked about and what's before us, Bill, we want to talk about what our schedule is going to be for the next few months.
Well, we've done some research, and I have to say that there's no magic day, time, place that we can meet and everybody can be there. In fact, from what we know, it's going to be pretty tough to, in some cases, get a quorum. After talking things through, I would like you all to consider whether or not a meeting schedule of every other Friday beginning January the 16th would be a useful time to meet. I think that for these kinds of meetings, it's going to be difficult to do more than half a day unless people want to do longer meetings. You can do it. But Fridays are probably the best way to get good representation from all of the individuals on the council.
I
have a huge problem with Thursdays and Fridays in January and February.
Likewise.
And the LCCMR is scheduled to meet all day of the 16th to do our retreat, at which one of the things we'll be discussing is how to have a relationship with this council and what our mission is in light of the legacy amendment.
The next best day. and this works a hardship on the legislative members, is Tuesday.
Perfect.
What is wrong with Mondays?
I'll just cancel my committee for this.
Yeah, I'm here. So.
Okay, all in favor?
Yeah, fine. You don't want me to appropriate any money.
Mondays are a doable day as well. Does that sound better?
Monday morning?
The situation with Mondays is it allows us some off rush hour travel times on Sunday evenings. This is a 400-mile round trip.
I'm seeing some nods of the head that Mondays. Scott, Darby, Jim?
As long as it's under a Monday, every other Monday.
Conference calls in the morning.
Well, which Monday is that?
I don't know which one it is yet. I know it's going to be, I think it's next Monday, and then it's everyone after that.
We do have, the Senate's in session every Monday morning, usually at 11, so
right.
I do have a little bit of a conflict.
We can adjourn by 11.
Great, perfect.
So it sounds like Monday morning seems to be the best time that will work, and what I'd like to have Bill do is propose a schedule of meeting every other week between now and the end of March to get us to that point, recognizing that we all have other lives beyond the council, but to try and make every attempt to get to those meetings. And I would suggest that, do you have a calendar?
There is in your packet a calendar.
Yeah. So given the work of the governance committee, I would suggest that that first meeting occur.
Session starts the 6th there.
That maybe, given the holidays, can we afford to wait to the 19th as our next full meeting of the council? I don't think so. Can we turn it around by the 12th and get information so we can have a couple? So let's plan on starting our every other Monday meetings on the 12th of January.
Morning time frame.
Morning time frame. And so for Scott, would you, and those, Wayne, Scott, I know Les, you've been coming the night before. Is that doable to travel so that we can start maybe 8 o'clock?
We will have to go the night before.
Perfect.
I don't think either one of us.
Scott, that's okay with you?
Well, yeah. If it's going to start at 8, then I'll have to come up the night before.
That's okay with you of traveling the night before? Great. Okay.
Is there any possible coordination of the governance meeting in conjunction on that same day?
Well, I think the governance committee needs to meet prior to that so we can have something proposed. And Bill, I think you're just going to need to work with governance committee and other members to find something.
Well, I would suggest that the governance committee meet Monday, the 5th of January.
Okay.
Yeah, that's not good for me. All day meetings.
5th would be great.
Sorry, how's Tuesday morning?
Tuesday morning, the 6th.
Oh, wait a minute.
That's what I wanted.
Mr. Chair, one thing, the longer we put the schedule out, the more it's cast in concrete, and we can change other schedules in accordance. Yes. I'd like to see the schedule projected all the way out to June.
Okay.
I've got it through March, but I'll get it out to June.
Bob, sorry to ask this question, but Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday next week?
Monday, Tuesday. What?
I could do Tuesday.
Tuesday. I could do Tuesday.
Les?
That's the 22nd, 23rd, or 24th.
That's my shopping day, the 24th.
Yeah.
You're getting real close to Christmas on Tuesday.
You can bring your wife.
What about the 30th? The Tuesday.
I have to be out of the state for a memorial service. I cannot miss it.
How about the 23rd? Does the governance committee members, who can't make the 23rd?
Well, I can't, but I can't. Don't worry about
it. I
can't.
I'm in hell, all places.
Long
ways up.
22nd, Monday the
22nd would be good.
Can I bring my kids?
That's what we're
talking
about.
Sure.
That
works. 22nd works?
I won't be here.
You won't be here. Who, Bill, can you make the 22nd? So we're no better the 23rd.
No, 22nd, 23rd is out.
Then we're looking at, it sounds like...
If I'm the only one.
How about the 5th?
The 5th of January? What was it?
I cannot do that all day.
How about January the 2nd?
Is that a Friday?
Nope.
Yes.
Yeah,
that's
a Friday.
That's the day after New Year's.
I'll be traveling that
Friday.
Yeah,
I'm out of town.
Okay.
Go ahead. I'm out of town.
Well, I think we need to...
I think we better get a date before we leave this room.
Yeah, we should do a show of hands for each of those dates.
All right, so
let's, the one with the most hands.
Yeah, so let's start with the 22nd, which would be this coming Monday. Would that give you enough time, Bill, to turn around and get ready for that meeting?
There are 24 hours in a day, so there's no problem.
Good. Glad to hear that. How many people cannot make the 22nd, which is Monday? There are two. How about the 23rd? Who can't make the 23rd? Same two. How about the 5th of January? Who can't make the 5th? Yeah, that one is... And the 6th?
What session? What time?
First day.
First thing in the morning. But we don't start...
And the 7th. How about the 7th?
Noon or 11.
Who cannot make the 7th of January?
I guess it depends what time.
What time would work, Ellen?
What do you have to...
Good question.
Talking Governor's Council.
Yes. Governor's Council, yes, Les.
The 7th might work.
Let's plan on meeting. It sounds like the 7th would work. Let's plan on meeting on the 7th. That's a quick turnaround before our meeting on the 12th. We're able to get our materials out and still be in compliance with open meeting law, Bill. When do we need to get materials noticed?
It'd The 8th?
The 8th.
Yes,
we'll do it.
Something that complies with the open meeting law in all fact ways.
Okay.
Can we do that on the afternoon of the 7th?
We will do that on the afternoon of the 7th at 1 o'clock in St. Paul. So those of you who are traveling can make it. And again, this is for the governance committee, and then the full council will start meeting every other Monday starting on the 12th in the morning.
I'm sorry, was there something on the 8th we're doing too?
The 8th is the roundtable meeting, and that's just if members are going to be going, that's their decision.
A different topic?
Rick.
Since we're all going through the calendar, could the personnel committee meet on the 22nd?
Personnel committee could meet on that. How about the 23rd?
I can meet on the 22nd.
Not the 23rd.
And the 23rd.
Rick, 23rd?
23rd. Jim, how about you?
23rd would be better for me.
Yeah, the 23rd. So let's plan a meeting on the 23rd. We'll get a notice on that as well for those who are interested. Okay, we're all set, Bill, in terms of what we need for meeting schedules?
Yes.
Start out our regular meetings on the 12th and every other one.
Yes, 8 o'clock in the morning. We'll plan an 8 till noon unless we give folks time to travel home.
That'd be fine. It's no matter what. You know, down the road, if we can make them longer, that's fine.
Sure.
4 hours on, it takes 6 to 8 hours on the road for a four-hour meeting. It sometimes doesn't make a lot of sense.
Mr. Chair, come on.
Yeah, Bob.
Sorry, Jim, did you, on the 23rd, what time of day is best for you? Both Representative Hanson and I can both meet in the morning.
That's fine.
Yep. And then, sorry, last one.
Okay. I think we're on to agenda item number 11, which is public comments. I know there have been some folks that have been waiting very patiently, and so now is an opportunity. If anyone in the audience would like to provide any comments to the Lasard Outdoor Heritage Council, now would be the time. Well, yes, please, come forward. Yeah. Hi, could you identify yourself?
Yeah. Robert Austin, New Prague.
Welcome.
Thank you. Very interesting. We covered one point here that you're calling everybody by your first name, and it's just weird. You know, just on an informal basis. That's the way I look at the thing. There's a couple of things I got here. The thing I got to keep in mind here is that this citizens' council here is it's a hook and bullet trapper, hunter, fisherman, sportsman's council. That's what this is. And we've got to concentrate and make sure that this is the thing that we're going to represent here, that you guys are going to represent. I got, and you're the co-chairman, and when evidently you're going to have elections for another chairman coming up.
We will be doing other officers next meeting on the 12th, and then kind of formally electing officers in June for 1 year.
Oh, okay, you're going to elect them in June.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. Interim officers next month, and then permanent officers for a year in June.
Okay. Just throw this out, wherever's going to go. Guys, it's going to be absolutely critical that when you pick a chairman, that it be somebody who's a hunter fisherman. And I think, and I don't mean to be poking at the three legislators here, but if you have on this council, the first chairman, somebody from the legislature, this is not going to go over well at all without state Minnesota. It's going to be bad news. I would look at, this is my feeling, for somebody that you look at very seriously, or guys that to have as your chairman be like Jim Cox, Les Bench, Scott Rall, or Wayne Enger, because it's just going to be critical that it's gotten across to the people that this is, you know, a sportswomen's council here, citizens' council. Another thing I had here was, you know, to try to get these meetings out of state, and I can, you know, I can see where that's going to be. That's a problem. I don't know how, you know. And it goes right back to listening to this open meeting law. I mean, this is, you know, this, I think it's going to be a negative for you guys trying to get this thing to go. And I, I don't know what the LCCM are, how you guys handle it. I mean, if you can get together three or four of you or whatever and meet and, you know, kind of open there. But and it's been brought up here that you, you know, some way or other you got to have gatherings or whatever with out-state people. You know, breakdown, I just, one of the other things, you know, like Jim was bringing up, where you're going to spend this money. Les brought up, you've got one project that's $1 million, this type of thing. And you've got the different areas in the state. You've got the forests, you've got the prairies, you've got the wetlands. Where I come from, New Prague, one of the things that we have down in our area, we've got lots of wildlife management areas. And I look at these as a possibility for this first year or something for, say, your local sportsmen's clubs to get involved in. I mean, a lot of them, they bought these properties and they've never really done anything with them. Gives them an opportunity to put money, and I'm looking at maybe you're looking at going to spend $5,000, $10,000, $15,000, $20,000, you know, small, you know, not huge sums of money. And then it's back to where you're coming from, Jim. There's how does somebody, they say the New Prague Sportsman's Club, how do they apply for a project? They pick one of these wildlife management areas, they go on to work on it. This is going to be a critical factor to, you know, to get it lined up so that they can apply for this. And it's got to be the KISS approach. Well, you know, it's keep it simple, stupid, because this thing gets complicated and it's going to be tough. It's going to be real tough out there. And the people that are going to do the heavy lifting out there are going to be people from the, you know, it's going to be DUPF, Minnesota Waterfowl Association, and they're going to want some, you know, be able to get some of this money without having to go through a lot of hoops. So, anyway, it's been... I don't know, it's just it's been very interesting, and I really think that you've got to get to the local people. This is where it's at, and these are the people that are going to, you know, pick up the ball and run with this thing and use the money and put them into projects. And I brought up the wildlife management areas because those are something that are there to get the thing started. And you guys, you're going to make mistakes, we're all going to make mistakes, and I guess it's just like, hey, you know, that didn't work, go to plan B and move on, so... That's kind of the way I am. So hopefully, you know, you don't hammer yourself, and people don't hammer on you when something doesn't go exactly the way it's supposed to.
Thank you very much for the comments, and thanks for coming up from New Prague.
Kind of a question.
Yeah, Wayne.
A couple of years ago, I proposed something called Adopt a WMA program, where every WMA in Minnesota would have to have some local sportsman's club. A tag onto it and say, this is my project, work hand in hand with the wildlife manager. And my thought was that something like this could go work well with that, where this group could then ask for some money to clean it up, do whatever needs to be done. I know the DNR calls all the WMAs their jewels of Minnesota, and I've seen some of their jewels that look like coal. And I guess I would rather see some money, as long as we're going to be putting in some money into acquisitions things, and also make sure that we have something similar to that, like an adopt WMA program or something, so we can actually work hand in hand with your WMAs. Is that what you were sort of talking about?
To me, it's you know, I don't know how much money is going to be. Until we don't start the tax till July 1st. Mm-hmm. You're not, I don't know, X number of dollars you're going to have, say, in the latter part of 2009. You got the wildlife management, or just if you're saying, I think this would be a great place to first. To try something, see what people have, see what works, what doesn't work, and I think it's important that you guys have something online that's going to be actually getting some stuff out in the field.
Thank you.
Les, did you have Mr. Chair, Bob, good comments. You touched on something that's been an underlying problem in the state, and that's the WMAs. 10 counties in the state have adopted a no-net gain program. The county commissioners, the county boards are tired of the supposedly perceived or actual tax inequities with the PLT payments. And this is a challenge to the legislature to bring the DNR together with the local units of government and figure out a solution to this. Some of the problems are totally perceived problems that don't exist. Some of them are real. But I think this is going to have to be addressed before any type of fee title acquisition and future WMAs is going to become a reality. So to our legislators, let's get our heads together with the DNR and figure out what is the solution to that. It's not that impossible.
Thanks. And thanks again.
Okay, thank you.
Anyone else in the audience? Gary.
Welcome. And if you mind, just for the record, stating your name.
Okay. My name is Gary Leaf. I'm the executive director of Sportsman for Change. I thought I'd talk about, there was a couple of elements that popped up that were interesting to me. One is, of course, I think the constitutional language that's been carried on this bill for a decade is reasonably clear. For what it's for, the matrix concept, actually I've been using in the field for about 2 years. The only difference is I try to use case examples. I can maybe give a couple of those. But another element, I just came from the other stakeholders meeting that popped up relatively frequently. They talked about wetlands, they talked about prairies, they talked about WMAs and so on. They also, right out of the gate, I was the second person that unfortunately was in the line that had to talk about it. The first person specifically talked about forests. And that's a major issue, of course, and that has a lot to do with access. But probably the major issue that occurred when I went around the table, I was pleased to see, really was access. And when you're talking about access, you're really talking about natural resource economics, because they are tied together. There's about, Minnesota generates about $3 to $4 billion in economic activity on fishing and hunting, employs 55,000 people. It's diversified. U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has done economic studies on wildlife management areas that start to plot out, if you put in WMAs and so on, what is the local economic impact to that community and so on. So a lot of that work has been done, and I think it's possible to. I definitely agree that the public is, doesn't need any more plans. If this evolves where we start seeing more plans coming out, there is going to be an outrage out there. And I wanted to kind of move into. They're moving it to the implementation stage. They want to see projects, and I also agree with sooner rather than later in terms of its feasibility. Now, of the priorities, if you look at that matrix, wetlands, prairies, and forests, and so on, there is only 1,800 restorable wetlands left in Minnesota to even restore. There's approximately 1,000 drained wetlands that would probably fit into the Constitution. The other two components, prairies and forests, is really going to depend on, and we've got a lot of experts in that area here that could really lay out what would be those. Those are, if we don't acquire them, they're gone. They're not just gone, they're gone forever. And that's the trend that's been in the other states and the like. So, and that's also combines, a side benefit of economics. It also provides, which is a major benefit, especially in this economy. U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, the economists, they hire have said that some of this gets to be kind of a fool's errand. It's very hard to track the economic effects of some of this, but some of it can be tracked. Forests involve access by grouse hunters, deer hunters, snowmobile trails and so on, but also berry pickers and other people, and a lot of the people that we've talked to in northern Minnesota doing a lot of outreach. We've done a fair amount of outreach. We had a capital rally here with 5,000 people attending, primarily waterfowlers. And I can tell you roughly what their views are on this stuff. I can roughly tell you a few of the others. We've done a lot of outreach in the last year and a half, and, of course, the campaign. So I think we've got, in the short run, we probably could define it that, restoration of shallow lakes is going to be the top item, no matter how many studies we do, no matter how many rallies we have, because it's a reality that we've lost 50% of our wetlands in Minnesota. They're simply gone. There are great books written about it, draining of the Great Oasis and so on. And I think some of those are just going to be keep coming up to the top. Christina's a perfect example. Lakes, we're on Swan Lake. There's a number of parcels that are becoming available. But I think a lot of the other types of projects are simply going to be opportunities in the market. You can't, with a static plan, ever get to that implementation stage, because we don't know what is available at the market. I think that the DNR will have those shallow lakes or that data on what are shallow lakes restorable in Minnesota, where are they, and what priorities of the 1,800. There's some down by Worthington of drained lakes where I was down in that area of pheasant hunting that has a great story behind it. A huge drained lake has an island in the middle of it that the Indian community used to seek refuge in from prairie fires and so on. There's drained lakes that are restorable and so on, shallow lakes and the like. So a fair amount of that a lot of that, a fair amount of that stuff has been done. That we've been out in the field talking to people over and over, and I think plans and articles in the newspapers and so on and so forth, and a lot of that it is out there.
Thanks, Gary. Any questions or comments? Yeah, Bob.
Very quickly, Gary, is it 1,800 individual wetlands that are available for protection or restoration?
Restoration. Well, protection, it depends on, you know, on what those would be restorable wetlands, but, you know, if there's some means to which you could protect those shallow water basins from future problems, that's a cheaper investment. Or let's say shoreland. We have some tracts that I've seen up in Brainerd that were classified as forests. They were along a shoreline. DU manages the wild rice and so on. It provides a broad range of activities and the like, but it also includes, you know, some shoreline. So not every case is definable, but yeah, around 1,800 shallow water wetlands, and those would need to be protected.
As you talk to people about the issue of wetlands, is it your view that in the definition of restoration, is restoration an activity that takes place on an area of land that once was but no longer is at this moment wetland, but has the potential to be restored to,
yeah.
Or is it
existing.
Arguably existing,
yeah.
And therefore can only either be enhanced or protected?
Basically, most the examples we use is Lake Wakanda, I believe it's called, out in Wilmer. And that's been looked at by the Pollution Control Agency, the DNR, and all the groups and so on. And it's typical where you have a multitude of source problems. You have runoff going in there that's causing excessive nutrients. Then the bullheads and the carp get in there. So it's useless. And that's essentially what a lot of those basins are throughout Minnesota, a lot of the remaining wetlands that we have. So they're using a number of different things, such as on Christina and so on. They're doing drawdowns, they're putting up buffer strips, they're doing a lot of different things to handle really two different convergent types of problems. But I think for most sportsmen, they're going to see along that lines. There's drained wetlands and so on and so forth. I haven't seen that many projects where they recovered drained wetlands that were drained. This one I'm talking about is 100 years ago. I believe it was down by Worthington. It was 100 years ago. I know some of them because my relatives were involved in the draining 100 years ago. So I'm very familiar and they caused problems at that time. But that was a different era in history and so on. So, but I think those restoration of shallow water wetlands is going to be extraordinarily popular. And that's not just with the remaining waterfall hunters. Every angler and hunter in this state knows that. We grew up with Les Kuba prints and all that and so on. That fall in the outdoors, that plays a big role, just as much as the grouse in the north woods or snowmobile. I mean, these are just part, and that's why people overwhelmingly pass this amendment, because it's who we are.
Thanks,
Gary. Appreciate it.
Thanks. I have a question.
Oh, yeah. Rick?
How do we, not everybody voted for it.
Yep.
And there are some regions of the state where very few people voted for it. And some of those regions of the state have opportunities for conservation, but you know the county may have only had a 40% affirmative vote. On the other hand, we have other counties. I think the 5th congressional district had 68% support. I mean, that's hundreds of thousands of people voting for it. But the 7th and the 8th congressional districts were barely at 50, and there were counties within them that had 40%. So as we allocate money and we have projects in areas where people didn't want them, How do we handle that?
Well, probably one of the areas is where, for whatever reason, never did as much outreach there. Certainly, if it's the hunters and the anglers, we can find those people. We can get them in one place. Northwestern Minnesota, up in that area and so on, places where we did poorly, it's a combination of, and really it wasn't that, you know, it was, we were maybe 5-10 percentage points, you know, it wasn't like it was totally against it and so on. We were up in that area. We weren't up in that area enough over a long enough period of time to inform them that a major problem up there pertains to access. They constantly have a lot of discussions out there about groups precluding access. So as long as access is carried over, the main stakeholders we can bring in to the process that clearly are access-oriented groups, snowmobilers, for example, or whatever you want to clarify up there, the more comfortable they will be to it. And they've had a lot of legislative experiences in the past that are controversial. And I'll just say the agency might as well. There's no more anti-DNR place in the state than northern Minnesota for a number of reasons. And so I think a combination of those factors is where we failed. And it was largely due to we just weren't up there communicating with enough people about, no, this is going to be about access. There is declining opportunities. When we did that with, I know, some large 500-person banquets in the Hibbing area, that was their message. I said, just give this message. It's about access and fragmentation, and it resonated. But, you know, it wasn't enough of it.
I think, Mr. Chair, just from a perspective standpoint, when we bought all the media to convince the voters, we went to where the people were to some degree. So what you saw in some counties were places where there really wasn't much effort put there because there weren't enough voters to make the difference in getting it passed. And I'm sure you saw the same thing. Concentrate where we can be most effective. So I think while you have a point, ultimately this is about heritage for everyone in Minnesota, and we can't say just because they didn't vote for it, we don't want to give them any money and restore any wetlands in their district.
Yeah, they do have wetland issues up there. Protecting them. But it's not like, the main message up there was forest related, where we tried to get it up there, but we just ran out of time.
Mr. Chair, a comment for you, Gary. One of the major information sources that we had, and we've alluded to this in the operating procedures, is the information dissemination of the programs. Sportsmen for Change was your baby, and that was probably the most significant information distribution that we had during the entire campaign. And I think we have to create and duplicate that in a major effort to distribute what information we're doing in the council and what programs we're doing in the council. So I would like to see a continuation of that website, that distribution source, to inform and educate the people throughout the state of Minnesota. And I have one other comment. We own land up in northwestern Minnesota, or northeastern Minnesota, and we did have active legislators that actively campaigned very vigorously against this program. And some of the comments that we received from the people up in that area were such that, geez, if we get this dedicated funding, we're not going to be able to have outhouses by our cabins anymore. It was so distorted, and the facts just weren't disseminated to those people in many cases. And I think once the program is identified and the benefits of the program, I think a lot of this negativism will go away.
No, just to make one, problem with a Red Wing Republican article eagle within the last couple of days, and apparently this council oversees all the money. You guys make recommendations on arts, water, parks and trails.
And we have seven done by April 1st.
That's right. Your job just gets easier, Gary.
And it's only 60, or how far is Red Wing? So, there's a lot of misinformation.
Great. Thank you, Gary.
Thank you.
I'm not going to go. I just wanted to. Real
welcome.
Quickly, I said the most important thing to last. You've mentioned the conservation partnership. But the most popular thing that I've been all my years in the Senate, and to the LCMR before even Ellen was on it, to Edison, was a small grant. You brought that up to $50,000, $25,000, $175,000. If you want a good rapport with Greater Minnesota, out of the gate, those little ones that have a simplified process, that, believe me, will do more getting around. And as far as Northern Minnesota is concerned, believe me, I've been to the wars up there. I can spend hours on this. But the last thing, Roger Holmes died this morning.
Oh, no.
And he, he was such a great friend all the years I served in the Senate with him. We had some great fights, but we were very, very close friends. And so I just wanted to tell you that we should maybe do something, or I don't know what we can do, but he sure left his mark. So I wanted you to bring that up to you. And maybe I don't know what we can do. That's all.
Thank you for sharing that, Senator Lasar. Yes.
Chair, just a quick comment. I would highly recommend to this council that we
gain and utilize Bob Lessard's expertise in that Forest Legacy program. We've had many hours of conversation on it, and we can glean a lot of knowledge and information from him. So stay in tune with us, Bob.
Any other individuals wishing to provide comments? Hearing none, motion to adjourn.
So moved.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Motion, we are adjourned.
It was more important than
I drove the short way today.
This is we sportsmen are tough. We're used to sitting in a deer stand 6-7 hours.
All right, get it. I walk for the way.
We'll say, you know what, though?
It's a poke, you know. This is
I don't want you to look at this unless you think I'm crazy.
All right, thanks very much.
This is wrong.
Yeah.